Welcome back to another edition of News from the Front, the podcast by gamers for gamers that features Flames of War, board games, war games, RPGs, SPGs, BFGs, history, books, movies, sci-fi, fantasy, miniatures, paint, and anything that requires a very tiny brush, but mostly Flames of War. We're broadcasting to you live from the WWP headquarters located atop the McLaughlin Tower located in Richmond, Virginia. And now the host of News from the Front and founder of the What Would Patton Do International Network, the man who puts the pants in Panzer Shrek, Steve McLaughlin.
Woo! All right, man.
Hey.
The McLaughlin Tower, I like that. It's like the Trump Tower.
Bring it at home.
Yeah.
Bring it at home.
That's right.
Big time. You've made the big time.
That's right. Very tiny brushes, huh?
Very tiny.
Very tiny. Well, I wouldn't know because I don't paint.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
But from what I've seen, they're
very
small
paint,
brushes.
But when I do.
Oh, I use very tiny brushes.
Oh, man, I saw one. I just got to say this real quick. Saw one of those pictures where people are making with that Dos Equis guy on the internet. You know, they're putting captions.
Yeah.
So it was the Dos Equis guy, and they photoshopped Wilford Brimley's face on it. And it said, I don't always eat cake, but when I do, diabetes. Dude. I laughed so hard.
And it's not diabetes, it's diabetes.
Diabetes. Yeah, it wouldn't be funny if he didn't say it like
trivia.
That.
Trivia. Wilford Brimley has tattoos of roses on his shoulder, and my friend Bob Knox did them.
Really?
No shit.
Well, that's bizarre. What a strange thing for that.
How do you like that?
I don't.
You never thought you'd hear Wilford Brimley and tattoos together on the WWPD podcast.
That's right. Well, you heard it here first. All right. So anyways, we got a big episode today. We got a couple upcoming events we're going to plug. We've got a little bit more of a debrief from Historicon. Just kind of going to focus on what we bought.
That was fun.
That was. I had a blast, especially in the jungle room. Yeah. We missed you, John, but John had a good time in Scotland. We'll ask him a little bit about that.
What they should have done with that room is had it just like they have with those e-cards you can open up, and as soon as you open the door, it says, "Welcome to the jungle, baby!
I know.
You're gonna die!"
Exactly. And coming up in Act 2, we've got a really awesome interview. It's with, John, why don't you plug? He's your boy.
It's with Tim O'Neill, who's one of the world's foremost experts on camouflage.
Yes.
And so we're going to be talking to him about just kind of camouflage in general, history, development, and then we're going to ask him, like, what the hell with all the crazy World War II camouflage?
Yep.
Like, Dunkelgel, what's up with that?
Yeah.
What's up with the blue junk in Africa and stuff like that?
Yeah.
So he's going to tell us all about it.
Yeah. It's going to be really cool. Then coming up on Act 3, frankly, we were going to talk about the British Armored Regiment, but I think we're kind of going to save that because it could get a little negative, and anyone knows I'm trying to keep a positive spin here. That being said, it may come up in After Hours.
I'm pretty sure it is going to come up.
I'm pretty sure.
Let's go ahead and make that call now.
That's right.
The British Armor Regiment discussion will be discussed in After Hours today.
We've got a mini noob zone, just a quick one, where kind of like last time how we talked about how important it is to allocate hits. Yep. This time we're going to talk about why it's important to turn to face, right? Because you have to in the shooting step, and it often gets skipped.
Yep.
Then I've got a cool review. I've got the Casino Map Case review, which I'll show you guys on the
break.
I've
already seen it.
You have seen it?
Yes.
Oh, they had it at Historicon.
I've seen it and fondled it.
Got one right there, right behind Dirty John there.
Ooh, I'll fondle it.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. We've got a response to the Battlefront question. We've got a new question for them. And that pretty much takes us through the episode. So we'll probably have a smattering of different stuff in there here and there.
It comes in this case?
Yeah.
It looks like a law.
Yeah, it kind of does. It looks like a map case, man.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Cool.
All right, so let's go through.
I just want to know if that's what we need to get to One-Eyed Willie's treasure.
Yeah, it really is. It is. All right, so guys, what have we been up to lately? I mean, I know we're still coming down off Historicon. John, why don't you start, man? I know you've been in Scotland. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I went to Scotland. It was pretty good, man. We stayed in, where did we stay? Ballyhoolish, Portree on the Isle of Skye. We went to Inverness and Edinburgh. It was awesome. Went and saw the Culloden Battlefield. I saw the Commando Memorial for where the Brit Commando is trained in Scotland. It's also where the 29th trained to be Rangers, kind of in that same area as well. It was great. No hiccups on the travel or anything like that, which you can sometimes get. And I didn't wreck the car driving on the wrong side of the road. And,
about that.
Yeah, it was outstanding. So it was really fun. Now, so other than that, then going to Scotland, as far as the game's going, I've been playing a fair amount. Played my Vandalure list that you guys all know and love.
Yep.
The other day, I got one victory with it against Brian, and then Ted killed every fig I had on the field, which I've never had that happen before.
Nice.
Killed them all.
Come flawless victory.
Yeah.
Finish him.
Yeah, it's like, okay, I don't have any pieces left, so I guess that means game's over. So that was good. And I've just been painting like a fiend, trying to get ready for this tournament that we're going to be talking about at Guns of August. I've been painting a lot of German stuff. Been painting a lot of stuff for Luke. I still haven't figured out how I got sucked into that. But just been trying to get my German.
That was
straight.
Your penance for not going to the store.
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly.
Well, we did miss you at the store, man. It's a good time. But we got Fallen coming up, which we'll probably start talking about in the next few weeks. So that should be cool. But how about you, Luke? What you been up to, man?
Well, do we want to talk about a little bit about this Historicon piece? Because it kind of all leads into the same thing.
Sure, man. Go ahead.
All right. So at Historicon, as you guys know, listen to the last episode. We did a lot of running around. I did a lot of shopping.
Yeah.
And spent a lot of time in the flea market and the vendor hall and went through with Alexander. And we picked up a bunch of Space Marines, and we picked up a Tau army, which was pretty cool.
Yeah,
and
cool.
Alexander got a lesson in how to negotiate with people.
Trader Luke.
There were 30 That's Space right. Marines that were very well painted. The guy wanted, I think, $60, and I told Alexander he could have 30, and he was like, well, will you go over there and ask him if he'll take $30? I'm like, no, you need to do it.
Nice.
So he walked over there, and he went, will you take $30 for your Space Marines? And the guy looked at him and just crumbled. and we got I think he walked away with probably 75 Space Marines from this little adventure, all painted.
So what did he buy for himself?
Exactly. I picked up a Tau army to play up against him, and I got a really good deal on that, so I was very happy about
that.
Cool,
man.
I also picked up a Russian army fully painted.
That's going to be
awesome. And it also came with cavalry. Which I am very,
I know,
very
that's
excited
your thing.
About.
I owe silver.
I'm an old Napoleonics player, so I like the cavalry, and I wanted to figure out a way to do it. And we'll talk about that later on when we come up to the section where we talk about Guns of August and our race for that.
But man, you know, the juxtaposition of cavalry and tanks is just too awesome, man.
It's just wrong.
It's so cool, though, man. See those big KVs and then guys on horses beside them.
Well, one of the things somebody said to me, I'm going to kind of get off the tracks a little bit. Is when, you know, they can't score a hit against tanks.
Right.
But if they were to attack crocodiles, which have to disengage, and they semi-surrounded them, the crocodiles can't motivate to, they have to break off because they can't. So cavalry could, in a sense, according to the rules, run down crocs and win. And take them, right?
Potentially.
Sure. So anybody out there listening who thinks I'm wrong about that, let me know some of the things we're thinking about.
You really have to maneuver it, but it's easy with cavalry.
It's very easy, and if you had a lot
of them.
That's
true.
Yeah. Now, the problem with the cav is that they're cheap. I think there's like four stands for 115 points or something like that.
That ain't cheap, but it's...
Yeah. Well, for moving 8 inches. I mean, and especially
for what they get. No,
but it's
awesome.
Neat, and they look great. Yeah. So what I've done since then is I have placed an order with Mr. Rob Eubanks, and I got a ton of new Russians that I'm going to be sending to Pete, and Pete has agreed to paint my Russians.
Nice.
In exchange, we're doing a trade for Bokash.
Oh, that's a
so
good,
he needs terrain. I need painted stuff. Yeah. He paints quick. I make Bokash quick. So
fair enough.
We're going to be doing that. I also
you've got figures on everyone's painting table because I've got your Stuarts in there. John's got stuff.
Right.
Now, this is kind of scary.
I think
right?
I've actually done my indentured servitude with these two.
Right.
objectives.
I picked up a ton of stuff for John when I was up there. Yes, I don't remember. Yeah. He can tell you. I don't remember. It was just a bunch of stuff I just kept picking up. But I also got 25mm painted samurai.
Yeah, I saw those. They look awesome.
Those are fantastic looking.
Those,
and what I've also done is I've gone to War Games. War Games LLC is actually having a sale, and they're 50% off on all Essex and Dixon figures, and that's wargamesminis.com. I'm throwing him a plug. I talked to Baxter the other day, but he's got thousands upon thousands of packs that he's clearing off for 50%. So I ordered three army boxes of Samurai 25mm, and I got them for what I would consider a steal.
Cool, man.
Absolutely.
That's awesome.
So got a lot of cool stuff, and then I picked up, I'm very proud of the fact, picked up a bunch of Dave's baggage train carriers. For the ones with the wooden cases on the outside.
Yeah,
I really like those.
Yeah, they're
cool. Not so great for tanks.
Yeah, but they're nice. Though.
But for artillery and for infantry, they are fantastic. They have the hard wooden cases. They're awesome. I love them. So after that, just a bunch of little miscellaneous stuff that I picked up here and there. Get your hand off me, John.
And I'm joining the ranks of not carrying my stuff around in paper bags or or pillowcases. I actually ordered $250 worth of cases from Battlefront. And
you got it from the Battle Foam.
Well, you have to get the case from Battlefront.
Ah, I see.
So I got that, but then I got their trays. But yeah, I didn't realize that they had trays specifically for the for British and for Hermann Goering.
Yeah,
so that's like, pretty nice. There you go, you sold me.
And they're really good quality,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, they're huge.
I mean, to be honest, if I were starting again, I would go with Battle Foam. But as you can see, I have like a million trays.
Other than that, I'm playing a game against John this Thursday. We're going to test out our 1,200-point list. And then after that, I've got... just got a bunch of bocage I'm making right now for people who have placed orders with me for it, and also for for Pete to get.
We could talk about those lists coming up. I mean, if you guys want to, I don't know if you guys want to be secretive, but I'll tell you my 1,200 point list, and I'm pretty committed to running. I think it's gonna be fun. But yeah, John looks at me.
I like it with
that.
Come
on, you're gonna change it up. Like I always change it. I change it 100 times. Yeah, but cool, man.
This is the guy who emails us like 7 times a day asking us. If it's a better buy for a Panzerfaust or a...
Oh, we have the conference call. Me, him, and he called when Brian was here for our Sunday morning game. Oh, yeah. This dude was like stressing out, man. It's like, all right, what is a Panzerknacker? What's a Panzerfaust? What's a Panzerschreck? What are the differences?
Well, I'm like, how are they based differently? You know what? I actually found pictures online of the Faust in 2-person teams.
Yeah,
I was like, wait a minute, I thought I just screwed that up. But I can't find in any of my books, I can't find anybody who takes Panzerfaust. I'm sure it's in
Hell's Highway. Oh, because you have the Italy stuff, right?
Right. So I got the Italy junk, and I got Dogs and Devils.
Gotcha.
But anyway. Yeah, let's talk about our list.
Yeah. Well, let me real quick talk about what I got at Historic. I don't know if that's okay with you.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to go ahead and cut me off, that's fine.
Go ahead, Steve-O.
And I actually didn't buy a whole lot because we've got little McGlaucho on the way. But
I made up for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got more than you did at Historicon, and I wasn't there.
That's true. That's true. But I did pick up, 10 of the Plastic Soldier Company Panzer IVs. So they look pretty cool. I'm excited about them.
Where'd you get those from?
I want to see those. Sergeant Major Miniatures. And I got to say, those guys are really
nice. That's Andy Turlington.
Yeah, you're right.
He's the owner of that, who's also the Fallen convention director.
I did not know that.
Yes,
that's awesome. Yeah, great guy.
Yeah,
and I ordered, I was counting yesterday, I have 35 of their T-34s and now 10 of their Panzer IVs.
So. I have to see those Panzer IVs. Have you assembled them yet?
Not yet. I'll show you the sprues, though.
I'd love to.
I'll get around to them. So that was my big purchase. And then from Battlefront, I picked up some Panzer Jaegers. And some of the little 15-centimeter self-propelled guns that are in Early War, they're built on the Panzer I chassis. They're pretty damn neat. And then I dropped a lot of money on decals at I-94. I don't know if... Did you see those, Luke?
I did see them, but I just breezed by them.
Yeah. He has these two big, like, rotating racks of decals for all kinds of different stuff. So I got some Soviet decals and American decals, and I got a ton of German decals. So that was pretty cool.
Is that where you got your little red numbers that I borrowed some from you?
Yes.
A while ago?
Okay. Those are I-94.
Next time we go, you got to point them out.
Sure. They're great, aren't they?
I'm going to buy a bunch. Yeah, they're awesome.
Yeah, they're really great. And I got some Africa Corps decals, like the little palm trees and stuff.
Yeah,
really cool. That's really all I bought. I mean, I spent probably less than $100 on, in the shops because I kind of need to,
Yeah.
Well, speaking of which, we found out it's a little girl. Going to name her Isabel.
Oh, sweet.
So that's coming down. My parents just left.
So you can call her Bella?
A normal just like Bella, name, yay!
Or Izzy.
Just like
all kinds of little middle
names. From, what is that, the vampire, the kid vampire
thing?
Oh,
God.
My wife
Eclipse.
My wife has a, quote, friend. I'm making the quote signs here for you. You can't see us.
Yeah.
For those of you, other than the three of us.
Okay, right.
Friend, somebody from... I don't know. She knew in her childhood, or whatever.
Right.
Named their two children after these two folks. And what were you saying? What's the
is it Twilight?
Twilight.
And
that is
one of them's Bella and Ellen something else. I don't even know what it is, but they named them both the same thing. And they didn't name the child Isabella or they actually
it's
named
just Bella.
Right. It's it's like naming a kid Liam. It's the name is William. It's a short.
My wife's gonna love that. She wanted to name our daughter. Isabel.
Yeah, it's a good name.
It's a great name.
It's a normal family name, too.
I want to name our daughter Amelia Ophelia Amelia.
That would be great. Amelia Bedelia Amelia?
I like Ophelia because there's so many horrible things people could do with that later in life.
But that's pretty much all I've been up to. I played an early war game with Brian. It was our farewell game. It was our last game before he heads to the left coast there. Yeah.
That's sad.
I know. I'm This one's for you, Brian. Taking a sip here.
Yeah.
Well, I would if
it's just my homie.
I did too. But that was kind of fun. I ran the reserve French. I don't know if you guys have seen those in Blitzkrieg. They're reluctant, and they have a bunch of fortifications.
Sweet.
But their fortifications are HMG bunkers, so of course Brian brings all tanks. I'm like, all right, well.
Sweet.
Those eight.
Did you play those 90mm British you could have attached to them?
No, I need to, because I don't own any. Because
that's what I, when we first looked at that, that's what I wanted to run as my I hate you list.
Yeah.
You know, was have all the bunkers and everything like that, and then put in those guns behind them.
Yeah, the armored regiment still pick it apart, but we'll get to that.
Because it's broken. It's,
I've never said a list was broken before now. Never, ever. I've always stood behind. When Sturm Company came out, people were like, no, it's broken.
You've got it here first, ladies and gentlemen.
That's
Steve McLaughlin declares broken.
That's right. And I have clout, damn it. I have a podcast. Right,
I'm going to argue with you about that. So,
great! I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah, well, of course you are, because you play it and you win with it.
Right. Well, that's like all German players who played the Sturm Company said, "No, the Sturm Company's not broken. Everything's fine."
I never played the Sturm Company. I still said it wasn't broken. I never played it. Never ran it.
I remember we went to that tournament and like every list,
every game I played, every game I played was against the Sturm Company.
They were annoying. I'll say that. But I think a lot of people hadn't faced fortifications at that time, and I've run a lot of the big push missions where there's a lot of fortifications. So I'm kind of used to them now. I can think about them ahead of time. But most people, I found most people facing the Sturm Company just didn't even know their rules. So it's hard to come up with a strategy when you don't even really understand it. But anyways, that's neither here nor there. Let's move on to some of these plugs we got, unless anyone has anything else that you've been up to recently. I think I'm good. Okay, so we got some plugs here. A lot of cool stuff coming up. It seems like it's the season for cool stuff. The big one we have is, well, there's multiple big ones, but here's one of the big ones. It's called Heat of Battle, Wargaming Convention. This is at the World War II Museum in New Orleans. It's August 12th through 14th, which is the same day as Guns of August. And these guys invited us down, and we really wish we could be there, but, you know, we couldn't make it. There will be a link, of course, in the show notes. We've also got Southern Front coming up September 23rd. That's
in
Raleigh.
Are you guys down for that? I'm down for that.
I'm going because I'm staying with Lydia's parents live in Raleigh, so I'm, you know, free place to stay. It's basically free.
I got to check. Just let me check.
Okay. So that'll be cool. It's a Saturday tournament, 1750. It's three rounds. And it's the first East Coast regional qualifier for the 2012 Nat season. So that's kind of nice. You know, you can
qualify and not go again.
That's right.
Let me pose a question for the Southern Front guys. Are you going to have the tournament table set up the night before so maybe we can play a pickup game?
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, because
is this a joke? Is this an inside joke or something?
No.
Why is he goofing? All right. Well.
No, maybe we can play a pickup game or something like that.
I'm always goofing.
Yeah, all right.
Come on, I missed a podcast.
What did I miss?
I got to get some goofing.
What did I miss? Man's had a little too much to drink. I'd also like to plug the Heroes of Armageddon again. You know, that's something we're always pushing. It's, you know, all the money raised for these projects that they sell goes to the Wounded Warrior Project. And they actually tapped us, unofficial. We haven't worked out the details yet. But the WWPD guys may all pitch in and paint an army to go up on Heroes of Armageddon.
Well, most of the WWPD. I want them to generate money for this
cause. I'm not painting.
Yeah, because I don't want to just repaint them anyway.
That's right. And on that note, again, we're approaching our 250 followers on Facebook.
201 today, right?
201 today. So 49 more people like our Facebook, and we're donating some money. Pete jumped the gun out there, but you know it's a good gun jumping.
Hey, you mentioned this earlier, so I'm going to throw a plug out for this guy. It's Sergeant Major Miniatures. It's sgmm.biz. A lot of people have been asking where you can get some of those 20mm stuff and where you can get...
Well, and the Plastic Soldier Company.
Plastic Soldier Company, which is the big one. Yeah. And then also I want to throw out a shout-out real quick to my buddy at Wargames LLC. That's wargamesminis.com, and they're the one that are having the Essex closeout. And as you know, Essex and Dixon cover everything. I think Essex are the best miniatures out there. So,
okay, so I've got one more plug here for Easy Army. This is, we talk about it all the time because Easy Army is the best, but these guys actually got all the lists from Casino up, and it's free. You do not have to pay for Casino.
Well, there you go.
So I think that now makes... Is Blitzkrieg free? I think Blitzkrieg is free and Casino is free.
It's ridiculous.
Can't beat it with a fish.
Freaking awesome. And actually, our boy Neil's been helping out with the data entry, so they're getting more entered quickly.
Neil Smith?
Yep.
Neil Smith.
Neil Smith. So shout out to Neil Smith, who's also running the Southern Front. I don't know if he's running it, but
well, he's part of the Triangle Simulation Society.
Oh, okay.
And he's a good. Yeah. Neil's just a great
guy.
Have
we met Neil? Did we meet Neil?
We met Neil, yeah. But it was only in passing. You hadn't really gotten into it much when, at that time, but yeah.
Yeah, I was too busy, like, yeah, whatever. And then I do that all the time. Yeah. I was too busy trying to win a tournament, which, of course, I didn't.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to the Southern Front. Yeah. I think that's all of our plugs except for one, and that is, of course, Guns of August, which we'll be talking about more and more as we talk about our army list. But that's coming up August 12th through 14th. It's right in our backyard up in Williamsburg.
Right.
And, Luke, you have more details on that?
Well, the cool thing about Guns of August, first of all, it's a smaller convention, but they are having a Flames of War tournament, 1,200-point tournament. They're having some Ancients tournaments. There's a whole bunch of different games. Here's some of the best parts about Guns of August. Number one, it's a little bit smaller. It's right off 64, so it's not that easy big of a drive. It's located at odms-club.com, and we'll let Steve put a link up. Well, actually, there is already a link on our site.
Yeah,
right
there's
now.
A big banner.
But
for
it's a local convention. It's at the Holiday Inn. It is a summer rate, so it's $79 a night.
Yeah, you can't beat that.
You can't beat that. Good. As a matter of fact, and I've said this before, I mean, we live 45 minutes from there. Okay?
Yeah.
And John and I are actually spending the night before down in the hotel.
Yeah.
Just so we can play
some games.
You guys
get in the jungle room?
They had one.
We're going to make a jungle room. So we're going to play some games the night before. We're trying to get Steve-O to come down too and have some fun. And it is just a great time. There's tons of stuff. They have role-playing games. They have board games.
Mm-hmm.
They've got vendors. They have some special guests this time around. They've got Martin Goddard from the Miniatures Market. They've got Peter Schweighofer. He's the RPG guest. Cool. They have Byron Collins from Collins Epic War Games. They've got a ton of people who are going to be there. It's just going to be a great time all around. So it's like a mini HMGS convention.
Yeah. I mean, it's the right size. And they're growing, too. This is only their fifth, I think, convention, because they've done three musters and two Guns of August. And they're getting it down. I mean, they really have...
It's just a lot of fun. Like I said, it is a local thing, but they've got a lot of people
regional
coming in.
It's
from
regional.
They've got people coming in from Jersey. They got people coming up from Florida. They got people coming from all around. So it's getting bigger and bigger.
It's going
to
be a blast.
I wouldn't be surprised down the road to see this as a...
Yeah, and I'd like to add, there's actually two Flames of War tournaments. There's one on Friday.
Right.
It's Early War, and that's run by some of them. I'm not exactly sure who's running it. Yeah. And then Saturday is run by the I-95 guys, and it's a unique tournament. It's 1,200 points. You can take a maximum of 4 armored fighting vehicles. Four. They were wrong in one of the descriptions.
Okay.
He said 5, but if you check the most... Are you on the I-95 email list?
I'm not.
He accidentally typed 5. He meant it to be 4.
Luck.
It's 4 armored fighting vehicles.
Tough. Luke's bringing 5, and that's all there is to it. He's going to go arm wrestle Eric Lauterbach.
All right, I'm telling you right now, it's 4. So... it's 4 armored fighting vehicles, and no more than 400 points tied up into your armored fighting vehicles.
That
so the idea is, I mean... They're trying to make it an infantry battle, you know, an infantry slog, which I think will be pretty fun. And on the subject of Guns of August, you know, special shout out there to our buddy Chuck Ternitza. And I'm going to go ahead and say Carl, Miniatures of Chesapeake. These guys are just so passionate about it. I mean, they come up, they're like, guys, you know, whatever you can do to help us get the word out. You know, we want people to come. I mean, they're really into it. And Carl also, he donated a building to the Stevograd. Cause he gave me one of the JR Miniatures buildings.
He's gonna hook
us
up with he's gonna hook me up with Arnhem as well as soon as I get over the 127 degree heat in my garage.
Yeah, good God.
Well, some of the things, just to let everybody know, children under 12 are free, and registration for the whole weekend is only $20. That's $20 for the whole weekend to get in. You get fit if you have a military ID, you get a $5 discount.
Mm-hmm.
If you run a game, you get a $5 discount, and it's just a great time. So. I think one of the things that's holding up a lot of the bigger conventions is the fact that it costs so much to go there. When you look at $120 for a hotel room, and then you've got to do that for 3 nights, and then you've got to pay $40 for the convention, all of a sudden you've spent $300 and you haven't eaten or driven there.
Yep. Exactly.
And that's a lot of money. So this is not it. And then here's the thing. You can take your wife with you because right down the street from that.
Outlet Mall.
The Outlet Mall.
You better believe.
There's Yorktown Beach right around the corner.
Bush Gardens is right there.
Bush Gardens is right there. If you want to make this a family trip, this is a great one to do. And there's tons of stuff to do. So I can't talk good enough about this. And then we'll talk about the muster coming up in in I think it's February, right?
Yeah, February.
February coming up down the road. So make it there. We are going to be there. Send us an email. You can send an email to any one of us at our names at whatwouldpattondo.net.
That's right.
And talk to us if you want to get a game in with us on Friday night. We're going to get there probably around, I know John and I will probably be there around 6 or so.
Yeah, probably about the same for me. I'm leaving from work.
Yeah, so. And I'll bring Wings of War and Talisman.
Cool. We'll bring Wrath of Ashardalon, which we forgot to bring to StarCon, which is fine.
We're going to do some stuff, and we can have some late-night gaming because the next day we don't have to register till 10:30.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. So everybody wants to play with us just has to bring a six-pack of beer.
Hey, that's the price of admission. All right, so we'll see you at Guns of August.
We're excited about that. Let's move.
Yeah, and actually I wanted to address that briefly, you know, a lot of people do ask us, can you plug my event? And we're happy to do that, especially on the website. But that is kind of why we have the tournament finder and everything, because the nature of podcasts makes them maybe not the best vessel for promoting things because they're eternal. You know, I mean, we record this now. Who knows how many people are going to listen to it in a year's time, you know? It's not like it's being broadcast on the radio.
I can tell you it's 4,368,862.3.
Oh, okay. You've been doing the analytics.
Right, exactly.
No, so just keep that in mind, guys, when you're asking us to do these plugs, because we can't really spend 15 minutes at the beginning of this plugging stuff that's going to be useless in a year's time.
Because it makes Dirty John bored.
Yeah, Dirty John is so bored.
Over time and
it doesn't mean we don't love you.
Right, exactly.
We do want to help you out.
Yeah, but send us out something individually, and then at that point in time, we can reach out and put something on the blog or whatever.
Exactly. So, that being said, you know, we're pretty much done with Historicon. What you got, Luke? After Hours? Yeah, okay. What do you want to say about After Hours?
Well, I did want to make a comment because people have asked me about that. After Hours has been going great. We seem to get a really good response at Historicon about that.
Yeah, you're right.
Even though I wasn't on the last show because you guys are jerks.
Because we don't like you.
Well, I don't like being sick.
Yeah. Yes, you do. You love it.
You're right, I do.
You love it. You can drink smoothies instead of beer.
You are right.
So, did you notice that he can have us over here when he's sick and he's like, I'm drinking a smoothie because I can barely talk. Come on over. But I'm like, achoo.
Oh, whatever.
I'm messing
up. You were like, I think I'm dying. I was like, you're not dying, Luke. You're going to make it. You're like, no, this is it.
Come over here and hold my hand.
Yeah, exactly.
Stop taking my core temperature.
All right, then.
Yeah, but we, I completely forgot what we were talking about. After Hours is great. It's $1 to download.
Right.
And we've been having a great time. And today we are going to be talking about the British Armor Regiment as one of the things that we're going to talk about.
Right. And I think we're going to try to kind of focus in a little more on topics. You know, in the past it's kind of been, let's just talk about whatever strikes our fancy. But we're going to have a little more of an idea. Not to say we're going to have, you know, real content. But
we're still spazzes.
We are total spazzes.
Yeah, I mean, it's real free-forming. So After Hours is new. We haven't really decided exactly where that's going right now.
Right.
But we will have some content. So you can look for if you're going to download, we're going to talk about the British Armor Regiment today. Because that's going to take a whole segment to really get into that.
It's going to be me and Luke head-to-head because Luke disagrees. Because he plays it, that's why.
I'm just going to be looking because I don't play early war.
Last time you guys talked about, and I want to see these before I leave today, you talked about the tank riders and how you put them on the clear bases. I want to see that.
And then
some of the modeling and stuff like that you guys talked about last time.
Wow, because what are you going to paint?
No, because
I'm going to pay someone else
to do it. I want to have an example of how to do it exactly. And this is what I want, but I actually do need tank riders.
Right.
So for some heavy Soviet tanks.
Right.
Man, I can't wait to play those damn Soviets.
Yeah, I'm excited too. And we have played a couple games. We played a little 450-point game per side, which is kind of fun.
Oh, yeah. We got to tell people we're doing infantry aces.
We are doing infantry aces. And it's going to be Eastern Front.
Yeah, and I got to ping Eastern.
I thought we decided to do...
Nah, man. You got vetoed.
Okay.
Everyone else wanted to do Soviets and Finns and stuff. So
I'm down for the record.
I'm down for either one.
I don't care.
Let Sean do his Finns.
Sean really, and they look great. They're actually right behind you if you want to peep. I mean, Sean has come a long way in painting. Yeah. But so I think it's going to be me, you, and Joe.
You means Luke.
Yeah, sorry. I'm pointing to Luke. And then John and Sean, and we think Ted are going to be the Axis side. Yeah.
Ted's coming along.
Yeah,
Ted kicked my butt.
We've got people who've been playing for years and haven't beaten John yet, and Ted killed every fig I had.
Yep.
That's ridiculous.
That's good. All right, so moving on, I'm just going to briefly do a little spoiler on Hellfire and Back. I got to browse through it for quite a bit at Historicon, and a lot of it's been already covered now on the Battlefront videos, you know, so that they've kind of gone into it a little bit. And basically, all that's really left that I can tell you, besides what's already been shown, is kind of some of the point costs and some of the basic levels. So, like, the Germans no longer have these hordes of Panzer IIs like you can get in Blitzkrieg. Instead, your basic tank is the Panzer IIIG, I believe. And we're pushing 150 points a tank at those guys. And the only real difference is that they get AT-7, and then you can upgrade them to Front Armor 4. So 4-3... 4-3-1, anti-tank 7, rate of fire 3, and when you upgrade them to Panzer 3Hs, and they're getting right up there. So one second, let me open up my notes. What are you talking about?
Oh, I'm saying that Luke brought me back about four Panzer 3Hs.
Oh, cool.
From Historicon.
So you'll be ready for
it. I'll be talking about that. I got John a box of miniatures.
He did.
Really?
He gave me a box of miniatures.
And people, you know, just selling this and that, and everything, and just a ton of stuff for him to paint.
Gotcha.
And that's why he was being my indentured server for painting.
Exactly.
Paying you back. All right, so I'll quickly run through. I made these notes here that I was going to talk about Hellfire and back, so I'll go through this quickly. For the Italians, they've got a new 8 million bayonets table. You remember how you roll for their ratings?
Yeah.
They're much worse. The only one I memorized is Elite. On Elite, a 1 or a 2 is reluctant trained. A 3 to 4 is confident trained. A 5 is fearless conscript. And a 6 is fearless trained.
So they're like goblins from 40K.
You have no, but that's what's so fun about them, man. That's like, they could
and
be
they
good.
They have big feathers in their helmets.
They do. Those are the elite guys. All right, the core tank units, the Kari, I think it is, it's 325 for 5 of the tanks, which they're pretty good in early war because they're armor 3, 2, 1, I believe. They've got 3 machine guns. And their gun is rated fire 2 AT-7, 4-up firepower. They're rated as elite, and they're identical in stats to the M14 in mid-war, except that they're slow and unreliable.
Ugh.
Yeah, so pretty big difference, because the M13 had a much weaker engine.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, you know, they have some cool support options. They have the medium armored platoon, which has the M1139. Yeah. I don't know if you've seen that. It has the main gun in the hull and a machine gun on the turret.
Right.
And they look neat. I mean... the Bersieri are the old organization, as by old I mean pre-North Africa. So they're the standard 7 guys per platoon instead of the big, like, companies.
Yeah.
They have no integral AT or HMGs in the core units like they do in North Africa, because that was a 42 reorg.
Yeah.
And they're elite. The Fusier, or whatever, they're really a fortification list. The core unit is 7 stands, and it comes with integral defenses as part of the platoon.
Really?
Mines, barbed wire, HMG, and AT nests. Yeah, I think that'll be pretty
neat.
That
is cool.
They're going to be fun to do. And then they also have the Motociclisti, which are like the new Blitzkrieg motorcycle cav, which is pretty cool. All right, so the Germans... all the units are confident vet, except for one of the infantry lists, which is kind of an infantry defense list, I believe, or confident trained.
Mm-hmm.
Their light panzer unit has the core of the Panzer 3G. It's armor 331, guns rate of fire 3, AT-7, firepower 4-up. And I have in my notes here that it's 460 for 3 of them. I may be off on that. They may be 420, but they're expensive. I mean, their basic tanks are expensive. So you only have one compulsory platoon, yeah. You can replace them for a Panzer 3H for 60 points apiece, which all that really does, I believe, is bump them up to armor 4.
Wow.
So you're paying 60 points to go from 3 to 4. Now, in early war, the difference between 3 and 4 is big, but still, you're just running out of tanks. But the cool thing is you can replace a Panzer 3G with a captured Stuart for minus 20 points, a captured Crusader for minus 25 points, or a captured Matilda for plus 155 points. Now that's awesome. Yeah, you can also replace them with a Valentine, but I hate Valentine, so I don't even remember what the points were. you can get light Panzer platoons, kind of like in Blitzkrieg.
Yeah.
The middle Panzer is pretty much the same. The core is still the Panzer 4D. You can upgrade them to Panzer 4Es for either 60 or 70, and again, that ups them to armor 4. There's an HMG company. The core units are HMG platoons.
What?
Yeah. You get 3 HMG units, and you can swap them for an MG team at the beginning of the game. But man, just think if you're defending against infantry and I have 12 HMGs.
Yeah, but you still get 5 up saves.
Yeah, that's still not very good. In fact, I said in my notes, that's a bit WTF. you have Schützen, Panzerschützen, Kreuzschützen. They're all pretty much the same as in Blitzkrieg with minor support differences. Then there's also the German, the Stutz company. They're like the fortification company. They're pretty neat. They have an integral. One of their compulsory units is a pack, an 88 nest. So that's kind of cool. And then they also get a PAC-38 nest and a PAC or a 2-centimeter nest built in. So they're kind of neat. and all kinds of fortifications, of course. And there's also a crazy 88 hero, but I hate heroes, so I'm not even going to talk about it. So great. Last thing, I'll just move on, and I'm only going to talk about the British armor because I didn't even actually get to look at their infantry. The armored regiment is back.
Sweet.
You now have to buy A-13 Mark IIs, so the upgraded cruisers. You don't have the option of the lessened cruisers.
Mm-hmm.
And they've split out the light tanks and the cruisers, so they're now in singular companies. So you get all 16 cruisers and all 16 light companies in one company. Mm-hmm. Besides that, the options are much the same. You know, you can get the A-9 CSs and the A-10 command. They have a lot more support options, though, in the desert, including motorized infantry that's confident vet and stuff like that.
So, how did the armor values or the AT values go up at all?
Nope, they're exactly the same. Also, you can't upgrade any of the Mark VIs to Cs. They're all Bs now because they didn't get any of the Cs in the desert. Yeah. So there's that, which I think is going to be pretty awesome. They can also take one company. Actually, I think they can get two companies of captured Italian tanks of the M13s. They're expensive as hell, though, because that Armored 3 makes them pretty pricey. But that's kind of neat. And if you've seen pictures of them, they painted a big kangaroo on the side, the Australians. Yeah, so that's pretty neat. Then they have the Honey Stewart Company. They keep advertising it as a regiment, but it's not a regiment. It's a company. It's the standard, you know, four platoons of three tanks. But they're about 100 points apiece. Though in early war, they are pretty baller.
Yeah.
Honey Stewarts are pretty baller in early war.
Luke's gonna get them.
I know. They also.
That's it.
I already ordered mine.
I gave him like nine.
Ahead of you. I have 8 painted, and I ordered 6 more to finish them out.
Painted desert camouflage, though.
Yeah.
Glad I got you that desert paint set, huh?
Yeah. Right.
And they're also there's a Crusader company, and they're kind of cool because I don't know if you guys have seen or are familiar with the Crusader. They have these. They have a deck turret machine gun, which mostly got removed. By later war, they stopped putting it on there, or they would just put their storage in there.
Yeah.
But so in this, you don't get it by default, but you can pay 5 points to add the deck turret to your Crusaders, which they just look cool as hell, you know. So I'll definitely be doing that as well. And then I know they have a Tobruk Strong Point, which is like a defensor infantry list. But
Australians.
It's Australians, and I don't know the stats on that. So that's all I have from Hellfire. More is coming out from Battlefront. We're probably going to try to get our hands on a copy to review ahead of time so we can spill all the beans. And I just got to say, this is the theater I have been looking forward to since playing Flames of War. It's just going to be awesome.
Well, we're set up on the desert table right now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
Well, yeah, maybe I'll review Wolf Heckman's Rommel's War in Africa then.
I could review that.
To coincide with it.
Word. So, yeah that's Hellfire in a nutshell. And
that's awesome.
Really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a blast.
Yeah, sounds great.
Cool. So, anything else you guys want to say before we take our first break and refill our beers?
No. I think I'm good. I think we're set at all, brother. All
right, so we'll be right back with our interview with Tim O'Neill. We'll have to give him a ring, make sure he's available now.
Right on.
That's right.
Ring a ding ding.
That's right. So, we'll be right back.
All right, thanks.
The Twilight Division Living History Group is always seeking motivated, enthusiastic members. Whether you're new to World War II reenacting or have some experience with another group or branch of the hobby, the 29th Division could be the group for you. We're one of the largest and oldest groups in the hobby with dozens of the finest individuals you will ever meet. Our group is primarily on the East Coast with most members in Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. Our unit maintains a high level of pride in themselves and the unit, striving for an accurate and professional impression. Our goals are to preserve the proud heritage and traditions of the 29th Infantry Division and the American soldier during World War II, educate the American public about the many sacrifices that were made by these GIs, and lastly, have fun. To learn more, visit the29thdivision.com. 29, let's go! Okay, guys, we're going to talk to Tim O'Neill, who's a friend of mine from the 29th Infantry Division Living History Group. Tim retired from the U.S. Army after a 25-year career there. He served in Vietnam and has served for 15 years as a member of the faculty at West Point. Tim is also a member of the permanent faculty of the Department of Behavioral Services and Leadership of the U.S. Military Academy from 76 to 91. Tim holds a bachelor's degree from the Citadel. He's got an MA in psychology and college teaching from the University of North Carolina. Also a PhD in experimental psychology and neuroscience from the University of Virginia, which I'm pretty sure means he can stare at goats. Tim is also the author of The Individuated Hobbit, Young Tolkien, and the Archetypes of Middle-Earth, and also the novel Shades of Grey, and also about a gazillion articles and monographs on military and scientific topics, especially on camouflage. I know, Tim, you've jet-setted across the world to talk about camouflage to a variety of
military and non-military audiences, and this is really what we're here to talk about as well. So, Tim, how you doing?
I'm just perfect. How are you, John?
Outstanding. I just want to get out of the way the catchphrase that I have to say every time I see Tim, which is, everything I am and everything I will be, I owe to Tim O'Neill.
All right. Fair enough. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us, Tim. We appreciate this, and we've been looking forward to this for quite a while now.
Yeah.
Well, I have been, too. This is a new one for me.
Cool. Yeah. All right, John, you want to take it away, buddy?
Yeah, so, Tim, as you know, we mostly podcast about a World War II miniature simulation game, and a couple of the aspects there we wanted to talk about specifically with your expertise are, you know, camouflage, because we play a lot of the and model a lot of the different lists out there, and there's all this wide range of different colors and patterns and things that people do, from seemingly almost nothing all the way up to kind of the German ambush pattern of camouflage.
Right.
And Tim, could you give us and our listeners just kind of a background and kind of the development of camouflage from a military perspective?
Well, systematically designed camouflage really started around the turn of the last century, 1895 to 1900. Two naturalists and artists, father and son, Gerald and Abbott Thayer, they developed the general camouflage principles, the intuitive principles we still use today for naturalistic observation. They look at animals, how their camouflage appears to work. Mm-hmm. Things like counter shading. If you look at a squirrel, the underside is lighter than the top, and that's to kill the shadow signature.
Wow.
We look at ruption, what they call ruption, probably closer to disruption, which is the blotchy pattern or the striped pattern that you'd see on a tiger or a zebra, for example.
Right.
There's a special version of that you see, for example, on a leopard. It's a special kind of disruption that matches background texture. Plus mimicry, essentially looking like something else, like a stick bug.
Right.
Other phasmids. And that's the way camouflage worked really through World War II, using the Thayer principles. Everybody used the Thayer principles.
Right.
People ask a lot about the strange dazzle patterns that ships used.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. A variety of reasons for that. Some of them are kind of simple-minded if you understand what the fire control systems were like in those days.
We're good with simple-minded.
Well, good. Let's start with that. The striped patterns that you see painted on ships in World War I and World War II mostly were on there because gunners were using coincidence rangefinders, basically looking at a target from two separate points.
Right.
Like the German artillery rangefinders, you see the guys holding up this huge bar with two lenses on the ends. Yeah. What you do is crank the one moving lens until the two images coincide.
Right.
Hence coincidence rangefinder. And there's a little cam and gear analog computer in there that computed the range.
Right.
Well, if you have a whole bunch of stripes, it's difficult to get a good coincidence, particularly if it's a little bit hazier, if you don't know exactly what you're shooting at. There are some other weird things. The old solution for a torpedo intersecting a ship, whether it was from a submarine or from a surface vessel launching a torpedo, was a simple analog computer called the ISWAS, and that essentially computed the assumed course of the target and its speed and the launching vessel's course and speed. Mm-hmm. There are four different variables you have to account for. To make the ship and the torpedo occupy the same space. Anything you can do to make the person running the launcher put the wrong information into the analog computer could save your life.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I saw one example of a destroyer that just had a great big white bow wave painted on it. So it would look like it was going faster than it was.
Hmm.
Since World War II, those have kind of gone away because we use different target acquisition and tracking systems now.
Right. Not so much visual.
Not so much visual.
Right. So some of the early development there, did they mostly go for uniforms or for armored vehicles or kind of how did that work out?
Well, they tried all at once. If you may recall, at the beginning of World War One, mm-hmm. the French Army was still wearing a blue top
yeah.
and red trousers.
Mm-hmm. They found out that didn't work too well.
La France, yeah. they very reluctant to give it up, but finally they went to what they call Horizon Blue, which was a light blue-gray color.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The Germans used field gray, Feldgrau. Yeah. And the Brits and the Americans used olive drab. Olive drab, by the way, what we call OD number 7. Comes very close to being the average color in the world.
Oh, okay.
You know, the world may look like a beautiful blue marble from space, but if you start analyzing the colors, it's olive drab.
Right. That's interesting.
Probably the color of shower stall mildew. In World War One, some countries did some camouflage work. The Germans had a painted pattern to go on their helmets that was used by assault troops.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Didn't work very well because it tended to be damp and the helmets would get worn and that would cause a shine, and the shine signature was much stronger than any pattern you could paint on it.
And that was that sort of tortoiseshell scheme, right? I think I've seen pictures of
that. That's exactly right. Cool. Yes, very much like that.
Okay. Yeah, and we see that in some of the figs we paint right for the Germans as well in World War II.
Sure.
They got kind of the same thing, and they had used almost like chicken wire to kind of disrupt the disrupting the curvature more like the American camo net.
What you're trying to do is kill the shine with that. In those days, American soldiers did a lot of things, some of them unspeakable, with their helmets. they would sit on them. This was particularly effective in the jungle, where you really didn't want to sit on the ground. You might pick up passengers. They would cook in them, they would shave in them, God knows what else they would do in them, because they could take the steel stamped shell off of the helmet liner, and they would tend to polish, and there would be that shine. So they would put nets on it. The engineer field manuals that tell soldiers how to camouflage their equipment talks a lot about using rubber bands or string or wire or the net to put on natural garnish or scrim, which is just a term for a fragment of fabric of any kind. Generally, you'd use burlap to break up the shape, the characteristic rounded shape of the helmet.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you get like a score of them out at a couple, you know, 1,000 yards. You can see them pretty easily rather than just say one out there.
Exactly right. They put out some bad advice too. For example, using mud to camouflage vehicles and helmets and whatever. Bad idea, because mud is dark when it's wet. When it dries, it's much lighter.
Right.
And it's easy to see dry mud in front of wet mud.
Right.
The same thing holds true of using natural garnish, twigs and branches and whatever, to hide yourself. If you pluck off branches and use those to hide, for example, spoil in front of a foxhole or stick in your helmet or in front of your position, it's going to die very quickly.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then it will be, you just look for the dead vegetation along the tree line and you shoot it.
Right. Or bomb it or call an artillery on
it. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, in World War II, the camouflage doctrine was very widespread. Camouflage, concealment, and deception were all over the manuals. There are several engineer field manuals that covered the waterfront to the extent they could with the technology of the time.
Right.
Much more than we have now.
Really?
Which is, it's on the books, but generally soldiers don't train very well with it.
Right.
Oh, the ones that depend on it very heavily, the Rangers, for example,
right.
Will. go to great lengths to camouflage themselves if it's appropriate.
Right.
And then, World War II was the high point of widespread camouflage, concealment, and deception.
Well, and on that note, do you know what the absolute earliest use of camouflage in warfare was?
This is like a quiz show.
No. I'm asking. I don't know the answer to that.
Oh, I don't know. It's probably back in the Neolithic sometime.
Right.
Good point.
people learned.
Ross look like tree.
Right.
Yeah, pretty much. Maybe you aren't going to be shot from long distance, but a mammoth might step on your head or something like that. that was largely empirical camouflage. You had plenty of time. You tried a lot of things. If they worked, you lived. If they didn't, you died.
Right.
And you passed them on to your offspring.
Little Darwinian evolution there.
Well, Tim, let me ask you a little bit about the American combat uniform in World War II, because if people look closely into it, you'll see if you look at the standard wools, your wool trousers are a particular color, your field jacket's a particular color, different than the trousers, your web gear is a different color than that. Your rifle is a different color. Can you tell us a little bit about how kind of that combines into a camouflage presentation?
Sure. There's a large fluctuation, or particularly in World War II and before, there was a large fluctuation in the color of uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because of the great difficulty in getting dye lots the same.
Right.
Basically, you ran off the uniforms and their colors or their patterns on a great big printing press, and every now and then some broad low to the ground guy with a couple of buckets of dye would come by and pour them into the vat. Yeah. We had a biggish army in World War II, you figure 11 million people under arms. And they're going through four uniforms a year. That's a lot of cloth.
Right.
So there was variation there. If, for example, you look at the field manual on camouflage for the individual soldier, it tells you what you can do. There are certain homemade dyes, for example, coffee really boiled down, that you can use to darken the khaki-colored load-carrying equipment that they wore. Mm-hmm. They were aware that was a problem.
Right.
And, of course, mid to late war, they shifted to olive, from khaki to olive drab.
Right.
But you could use that to darken
uniforms.
The first camouflage uniform we used was an adaptation of a commercial hunting pattern that the Marines adopted. They took it into the jungle, and they got rid of it fairly soon. It worked pretty well at first, but the dyes were unstable and they tended to fade very quickly. It was a different dye, a different chemistry than the dye that they used for their dungarees, by which I mean the OD green herringbone twill, the utilities. So that got to be a problem. The Marines, if you recall, went into Guadalcanal in khakis.
Right.
It was the tropical uniform.
Right.
In fact, there was a big arm wave at Army Ground Forces and went all the way up to the Chief of Staff about what soldiers should wear when they went into North Africa.
Right.
The khakis were cooler, but somebody figured the wool, the mustard brown wool uniform would be more durable.
Right.
And would work just as well. So they, army in North Africa sweated around in the Sahara Desert with a uniform. I guess makes you strong.
The right way, the wrong way, and the army way, right?
That's pretty much it. As Nietzsche once put it, what does not kill me really messes me up.
Right. Yeah, well, talking about some of the kind of strange, there's some strange things that can serve as camouflage. And I recently got back from Scotland and went over there and looked at some of their weaved tweed fabrics. And, most of that, I was told, comes from the hunting outfit that they would use, and that a lot of those tartans and tweeds really serve as a camouflage.
It's not impossible. I think the Stuarts and the Campbells might have a little bit of problem.
Right.
Whatever. It might have been the, of course, the ghillie suit comes from Scotland.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't know that.
The Lovat Scouts.
I have a ghillie suit myself that I wear on Halloween. The Gaelic word for a gamekeeper is ghillie.
Ghillie, yeah.
Yeah, I have a birthday suit that I wear on Halloween.
Well,
that doesn't camouflage.
It doesn't camouflage well. It's basically bright white.
Well, a little blue woad can work wonders. But
I would like to see a big camouflage. They did. On that
the Highlands are kind of open. Mm-hmm. The only thing you can hide behind is dirt.
Right.
Heather's kind of is not very effective for cover. So they would have a sort of a tarp that they would carefully camouflage. Will allow them to stalk deer.
All right. Well, I got a couple of questions.
That's right.
Kind of specific questions that we'll go through here, Tim, and see if you can help us out with some of these. We kind of pre-shared some pictures, and maybe we can put those up on the website, Steve-O.
Sure.
But I guess this is my question. My first one is what's up with the German Dunkelgelb? I mean, they ended up painting their tanks yellow, which just seems a little counterintuitive to me.
Well, Dunkelgelb means dark yellow.
Yeah.
What you do is take yellow paint and you add black pigment until you like the color.
Mm-hmm.
That's where olive drab comes from.
Oh, okay.
Right. You know, I don't know. I was not impressed by the Dunkelgelb. It might have worked well out in the steppes of Russia. They combined that with a standard forest green,
mm-hmm.
and a red earth color.
Right.
I'm not sure where they found ever found the combination of those three colors.
Yeah, seems a little strange.
There was enough contrast that it might have made it difficult to recognize the type of vehicle.
Right.
But I'm not sure how much good that would do you.
Yeah, and I think the paint all varied as well during World War II because they issued the paint to be either mixed with, gasoline or water, and depending upon how the person at the particular...
Yeah.
Because I think they issued the actual German armored vehicles in that primer red. And then field troops would go ahead and paint them, and then who knows what the heck you're going to get out of that out of those paints.
I think a lot of that depended on the factory, though, because some of them came out in that rust red kind of.
Yeah. Okay, so you don't know what's up with that Dunkelgelb either. So,
right, so
if Tim doesn't know,
if he doesn't
knows.
Know, yeah, it's a crazy thing.
By modern standards, the brightness contrast between the pattern elements is too high.
Right. Right.
I don't know what they were trying to do. I would have added a little bit more dunkel to the gel and maybe brought it down to that pea green that the Russians seem to favor.
Yeah. Maybe they figured that we got tigers. They can't blow them up anyway, so who cares?
That's right.
All right, so another one is the strange kind of blues and bright whites that were included in some of the British camouflage in North Africa seem very strange as well. Could you talk a little bit about how that might have worked and the theory behind maybe some of that?
Good question. I've seen the picture of that Matilda with the odd colors. If it's possible to do it, I'm sure somebody has done it. And what they were thinking about, I'm not entirely sure. Here is my guess.
Mm-hmm.
Operating in the desert on fairly flat ground, you're going to pick up vehicles on the effective horizon. That is, at the point where the curvature of the earth can no longer hide something coming towards you.
Right.
That's a pretty long distance away. Of course, you'll see the dust cloud coming up before that. But
right.
Now you're peering into that dust cloud, and right on the horizon when it's extremely hot you can have some optical distortion, you know, the kind of rippling effect right on the horizon that you'll see.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they were supposed to be combining earth and sky
right.
And make it more difficult to see. Actually, back in the mid-80s at West Point, we did a test of different kinds of dazzle patterns
mm-hmm.
With an incredibly zany Rube Goldberg simulator that used large radio control tanks and twin video cameras mounted on a pan and tilt that went back to gunner's controls, then a strange display that allowed you to track the tanks as if you were a gunner tracking a target. Mm-hmm. And we put different patterns on them to see if we could find one that had an effect. We did find one that had an effect. However, it had an effect only in driving the center of aim off the center of vulnerability of a moving target. It was so weird that it wouldn't have helped to hide it if it stood still. So it was an interesting exercise, and scientifically we learned something, but it really didn't go very far.
Sounds like it could be a fun video game, though.
I think so, too. In fact, I'm reluctant to talk about any current operations, but I will say this. We are looking at using versions of a popular combat video game that will allow us to essentially reskin the figures in different camouflage clothing.
Cool. Wow.
And we can use the scoring system on the game to effectiveness.
Well, today, sounds like an excuse for you to play Call of Duty.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking too.
Well, today's video game was yesterday's military simulation.
That's true.
Indeed, yes. And we have this brand new lab that I had made at West Point we call Emacs. It's a great curved screen, 23 feet wide and 6 feet tall, with 120-degree field of vision that's served by three HD projectors that have a digital interlace so you can't see the joint between the images.
All right.
We're really looking forward to running some of these souped-up...
Do you guys need a tester?
Yeah, do you need any consultant?
Yeah, that's right. Volunteer. I offer my services as a video game consultant.
I have a lot of trouble, you know, getting experiments done between the NBA playoffs and at the start of the football season. But,
nice. That makes sense. All right, I got one more for you, Tim. Well, actually, I got two more for you. One is the Denison smock that was very popular with the British Airborne when they basically took the kind of the khaki colored light colored smock and painted it with brown and red just with a kind of a paintbrush.
Yeah,
is that kind of one of the that seems to be one of the forerunners of kind of the woodland, you know, or adaptation for military use of the kind of the woodland camo pattern.
That's really a mimicry pattern.
Mm-hmm.
The old woodland pattern of about, you know, 10 years ago,
right,
from the 80s through the middle part of the last decade, actually was designed in, I think, 1948 at the Engineer Research and Development Laboratory.
Wow.
They changed the name of it several times because nobody liked to say he worked for Ertl. But it was pretty effective. And when they adopted that back in the early 80s, they simply blew up the coarseness of the pattern, I think 1.7 times or something like that. Yeah, it worked pretty well. Since you mentioned the painting, I worked with the Marine Corps snipers. And to an extent with other sniper operations and law enforcement. And they will take, for example, snow over whites.
All right.
And simply camouflage themselves with a rattle can. And they have good colors for that. That's not something you want to give to every GI because the snipers are a community that are really trained in camouflage. And if you... give a white oversuit and a bunch of paint cans to
a bunch of E2s.
You're going to get gang symbols. You're going to get God knows what else. But one of the things that I had built in one of my commercial combinations is a stencil that can be used to spray the colors on.
All right.
It's essentially a stencil mounted on a mesh. So that it's easy to use.
Okay.
Very cool. I have a quick question, if you don't mind. How is camouflage effectiveness tested in modern practice, or I guess more specifically in World War II era? Was it just kind of get some guys and see if they can spot it, or was there a set method for testing it?
I think get some guys and see if they could spot it was about the peak of effectiveness at the time. There just wasn't a lot of time to mess around with it.
Right.
There were a lot of things that were in the book that were just never done.
Right.
They were actually pretty sound. There wasn't much in the way of camouflage patterns except the one item that the Marines wore, which was adopted by, I think, the 2nd Armored Division.
Mm-hmm.
Coverall form. The paratroopers, before they went into Normandy, some of the units would take a dye made of old coffee grounds and God knows what else, and they would essentially tie dye the uniforms. They'd not knock them. They'd knot them up and put them in the washer with the dye, and would actually create a pattern. It wasn't all that bad.
Hippies.
The khaki anyway.
Yeah. The first hippies, that's pretty funny. All right, Tim, I don't have any more kind of camo questions. Do you got one more, Steve?
I had a question about the LRDG, but I think I know the answer to it after he mentioned that. I was going to ask why some LRDG trucks were painted pink, and it probably has to do with the fact that they raided in the dawn or the dusk for that kind of, you know, against the horizon. Do you know anything about that, Tim?
I've looked at it, and there are a couple of things. First is maybe the desert was that color.
Right.
True.
It's sand desert, and you know, sand used to be rock.
Yeah.
And a lot of sandstones and ground down igneous rock are kind of pinkish in color.
Right.
The other possibility is they didn't have enough sand paint to paint their vehicles, and they had to eke it out with a little bit of red lead primer. That would be another guess.
Okay, I got one more question, Tim, and I'm going to ask you to tell a story. Can you tell the engineering vehicle exercising story where you went out with the forward observer and you had an interesting moment? This is just the best story. Now, what do all Army stories start with?
Can I say that on
Yes, the, you could say that okay, on this.
Now, this is no shit. A fairy tale begins with once upon a time. A war story begins. Now, this is no shit.
All right.
I was with a tank battalion in the northern part of Republic of Vietnam. And we had our full table of organization equipment over there, which included armored vehicle launched bridges. And they sat up in the motor pool. This was basically an M60 chassis with this great huge scissors bridge sitting on the top.
Okay.
But we had no need for it. So they sat in the motor pool, and they sat in the motor pool, and the seals were going out, and the gaskets were rotting, and rust was starting to spread. So the battalion S4 said, look, well, we got to take these things out and get some use out of them. I think O'Neill's company is the way to go because he really ticked me off last week. So we rumbled out on this three-day exercise looking for the hated enemy with this stupid armored vehicle-launched bridge.
That is of no use at all to you, right?
It's good for crossing ravines. We didn't have any ravines to cross. I suppose you could erect the thing and then use it like a giant fly swatter. So we got into a logger and into a defensive position to scope out the terrain. We're up on the high ground, and the artillery forward observer who was with us said, look, why don't we erect this thing straight up? I will shinny up to the top of the treadways, and I'll really be able to see a long way. Okay, whatever. Everybody's sitting around eating their sea ration lunch, and this thing, the lieutenant climbs up to the top of the treadways, and he's sitting there kind of looking around at the terrain. Well, off in the bushes about, I don't know, 75 meters away, here's two little North Vietnamese, Nguyen and Han, let's say, and they have between them one RPG round. They're looking at us, and Nguyen says, oh, comrade, what is that? I never seen nothing like that before. And Han said, whoa, maybe some kind of radar. Well, they must have been new. Nobody in his right mind would have risked a shot that close to a tank company, but they could not resist. You know, it's an impossible target to miss. So they kind of snuggle in there and they pop one round. I'm standing up on top of the back deck looking around. All of a sudden there's this pop and RPG round comes in towards the center of the logger site. Well, there are two treadways with about a 2 foot space in between.
Right.
The round goes right between the treadway, about 5 feet underneath the forward observer who's watching this whole thing.
Who just
he's seeing the round from above.
Who just had a moment, presumably.
Just had a moment. one of those that, you know, always take a take some spare underwear. And the thing just went right through it and sailed on past the perimeter and into the bushes on the far side. Well, what happened after that was not too charitable to a couple of really gutsy little guys, but
wow.
That we did find a use for the armored vehicle launched bridge.
There you go. That's good.
That's awesome.
All right.
Well, thanks, Tim. Unless anybody's got any other questions, I think we've got everything.
I'd like to know how a deer, the camouflage pattern, is made so that the deer can't even recognize it as something being there.
Okay. As you're probably aware, I do.
Because I did some history on sure. I did some reading.
Yep. There you go.
We have a line of deer hunting patterns. There are three available now. They're made by Gore Associates, the Gore-Tex people, and marketed by Sitka, that have been on sale now for a couple of years, and we add a different design every year. Here's how we do it. There was a team of us, me and Guy Kramer, who's the designer we use. He's got a fantastic set of computer algorithms. He's up in Vancouver, British Columbia, and a wildlife biologist named Jay Knights out at the University of Washington, who's an expert in animal vision. Mm-hmm. What we did was pick the colors that the deer can't see very well. Deer are dichromats. Mm-hmm. We see three general center range colors. They see two. Mm-hmm. So the world looks a little bit gray to them, but you can see they're picking up some yellows and greens and a little bit of the bluish end. So that's how we came up with the colors. Now, when we look at turkeys, we look at a different kind of color vision and so on. But for the deer, we've got that pretty well squared away. Now, the deer, their visual acuity isn't quite as good as ours. They're about 20/40 Snellen. They could just maybe barely pass the driving test. Mm. Well, I mean, they could pass the visual part. I don't think they're really good on the...
Yeah, I think they're really on the other end of most vehicles.
And determining, how, by the way, what they can see and what they can't see is a real nightmare that I will leave to the comparative psychologist, because the deer don't fill out questionnaires very well.
Right.
They're not terribly cooperative. And it takes a long time for it. They're all under 18, so they have to have to sign a waiver. It takes most of their life to learn how to waive their rights.
At least they taste good,
which they do in the finality of the test. I'm sure
that's right.
So basically, we blur it a little bit. We use a macro pattern, a large light and dark pattern that tends to break up the shape of the hunter. Look up Optifade, OptiFade.com, and it'll tell you all about it.
I have one last
another video clip from me.
I have one last question before we wrap up.
Yes, sir.
How, as far as the combat survivalness for a modern soldier, because I was looking at the graph that you had on the HyperStealth.com site, the MARPAT camouflage, it says it has basically... almost three times as takes as much three times longer to recognize somebody in that camouflage. Do you have any kind of way of saying this will provide how much extra protection or when it comes into, you know, projections for survivability for our troops, how much that will have an impact on them?
I'm not prepared to discuss any current military
initiative. Oh, I thought that was already out there because I saw it on the site. I'm sorry.
And I don't, you know, that's I don't work for HyperStealth. That's their their site, and I really can't address that.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Luke's fired, so don't worry.
I will say that, you know, we can look at performance in terms of probability of detecting a target within a certain amount of time and compare a bunch of patterns that way. We can look at time required to detect the targets. We can look at blending studies. We can do any of a number of things. The trouble is translating that into, for example, a probability of being shot in combat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So many variables.
Fortunately, yeah. Mathematically intractable.
Yeah.
Right.
There are just too many variables.
Yeah.
Some of them we just don't have.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Well, I think that wraps it up.
Yeah, awesome. Thank absolutely. You so much for being here today.
Absolutely. Thank you. That was very interesting.
We appreciate it.
All right. Any last words, John?
That's it.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Tim.
All right. Thanks again.
All right.
Thanks.
All right, guys. So I think we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Act 3.
Right on.
MG42 Painting Services is proud to be a sponsor of the WWPD podcast. MG42 Painting Services is your one-stop shop for all your Flames of War hobby painting needs. Our painting prices can't be beat, and your satisfaction is 100% guaranteed. Our painting prices always include cleanup and assembly, black primer coat, and flat seal finish at no additional cost. Plus, buy your minis directly from us and save twice. First, get a little off the Battlefront price, and second, save the cost and hassle of shipping to us. Visit mg42painting.com for lots of additional information or to request a free, no-obligation price quote. MG42 Painting Services, where you get the best painted miniatures at the best value for your gaming dollar, guaranteed. MG42 Painting Services, mg42painting.com.
The official game shop of WWPD is Waterloo Minis. Waterloo Minis is a great source for Langton miniatures, Ancients, Renaissance, Anglo-Dutch Wars, Napoleonics, Great Lakes, ACW, and 1-1200 Napoleonic and Anglo-Dutch scale sailing ships, both painted and unpainted. Check them out at waterlooMinis.com and get free shipping in the U.S. Tell Rob that we sent you.
And we're back.
All right. That was a solid interview with Tim, wasn't it?
He's a smart guy.
Yeah, it was good stuff. Yeah.
Outstanding.
Yeah. Good friend of yours. How long have you known him?
Tim, maybe 3 years or so like that.
Oh, okay. Did you meet him through the 29th?
Yeah, through the 29th. Yeah. He's one of the main guys in the 29th.
Oh, very cool. Very cool.
Yep.
All right. Well, moving on here. You know, we had in the notes we were going to talk about the Armored Regiment, but I think we're going to save that for after hours.
Yeah,
because it could get a little ranty, and frankly, I think it's been discussed to death on the forums. So if either of you guys have been on the Battlefront forums lately, there's a good chance you've run into a thread on the Armored Regiment, and I'm a little bored with it now. So let's talk about Noob Zone. This is just kind of a quick one, and
that's right.
We're going to talk about rotating to face the target. Why is that important, John?
Well, a lot of folks don't bother doing this, but basically, as part of shooting, once you determine if someone's in your arc of fire to the forward, you have to rotate either your turret or turn your vehicle to face a team in the target platoon.
Right. A valid team in the target platoon.
Right. One that you can actually see.
Right.
And folks don't always do that, and it's usually not very important.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you rotate, it doesn't count as movement.
Correct.
You don't have to make bog checks or any of that.
Well,
if it
doesn't count as movement if it's in your 180.
If it's in your 180, right. And, that's we're assuming we've already gotten to shooting.
Yes. Yep.
And you've determined that,
you've got somebody
you can shoot at. Right. And then you go ahead and turn. But it can come into play, especially if you're playing bocage boards and there's narrow terrain and you can't physically turn that stud.
Correct.
Or shtunk,
as
they say. We just say stud.
Yeah.
If you can't turn that thing to face a team, then guess what, brother? You can't shoot.
That's right.
And most folks don't usually bother to do it because, like I said, 9 times out of 10, it really doesn't matter.
Frequently doesn't, but...
But it does change your facing for next turn.
That's right. Changes your facing for the enemy's turn. So he's going to have an easier time getting behind gun shields, getting to side armor.
Yeah, that's the biggest part for me.
Exactly.
That can affect a lot of things. And it also changes your forward arc.
That's right.
For the following turn.
And also, if you, like you said, if you physically can't turn, not even if you're in narrow lanes, if you deploy all your guys right up next to each other, how you can't rotate. You can't do that.
Right. And usually if you've got tank teams and things like that, with a turret, it usually doesn't matter that much. Although You know, the different armor sizes, stuff like that. So, on that note,
something I want to talk about really quickly is Phil said somewhere, and I don't know how official this is, but I think it's on Morrigan Lessons from the Front, that a tank with a turret can rotate their hull within that 180. They can basically take the same benefit as a hull-mounted gun. Now, I don't do this because I don't know how official it is, and I don't feel like explaining that to an opponent. But he said, basically, you shouldn't be penalized for having a turret.
Sure, you can do. You can pretend.
So it's basically, you can do either one. You can either rotate the hull, or if it's behind that 180, you can rotate the turret, and it not count as
Yeah, and there's also a rule on there, I believe, and Steve, help me out here. I think there's one where if you turn to face an enemy team and another enemy team is no longer in your arc of fire, you can still hit that team.
I think you can do that. I'm honestly not sure about that. I'd have to think about that.
And there's another one. I actually screwed somebody in a tournament on this. Sorry if you're listening to the podcast. But during movement, immobile guns can turn.
Yeah, they can rotate.
They can rotate. Right, they can do that.
And they don't lose Doug in or anything.
Right. They don't lose anything like that and whatnot. Yeah. But yeah, so anyway... I guess the point of this short, mini noob zone is for everybody out there, go ahead and when you go ahead and choose to shoot at a platoon, don't forget to take your enemy, take your teams and point them at some valid enemy target before you go ahead and roll the dice and everything. Because it can definitely make a difference. When Brian and I were playing the other day, he ended up where he had a guy in some narrow lanes. He had a stuck, and he couldn't really rotate it to face one of my teams. And we were playing a friendly game, so we went ahead and kind of maneuvered the guys to make sure that he could shoot people and all of that stuff, which is fine. Yeah, it was just friendly game, fine. But if you're playing a tournament and you've got your guy hemmed in, your stug hemmed in between two hedgerows. And you can't turn it to face that open field. What happened for dog bitch? If you can't rotate it to face that that field, then guess what? You can't shoot.
Yeah,
it's not enough just to be in arc of fire.
And it's the same with artillery.
When you turn your artillery, it doesn't count as movement, though. Correct.
Correct. Does not count as movement
because that a lot of people.
Oh, wait. In the movement step, if you rotate, yes.
In the movement step, but I'm talking about turning to face your gun. So if anybody's in your forward arc, right off your front. You have to turn to face them, and that does not count as movement.
Exactly. So yeah, and in fact, I think there's Morrigan Lessons from the Front. If it's the movement step, and you have a tank team in woods, and you move your turret, it's movement. Roll a bomb check.
Yep. And that doesn't really come up in the movement step because 9 times out of 10, you're not going to move just your turret. But in Stormtrooper, if you're adjusting where your turret's pointing, it's a bog check, brother, because it's a movement step. Yeah, which is a little wonky. I mean, you can justify it saying, look, you still have a massive gun in a wood or whatever. It is kind
of... Yeah, it's a little weird. So anyway, I guess the point that we have, with most of the noob zones is go back to the rule book, which we say all the time, over and over and over again, and we have to continually do ourselves.
That's right.
Is go all back to the rule book, pay attention to... the rules surrounding turning to face a valid enemy team.
Yep.
And
download Morrigan Lessons from the Front.
Yeah, download that, which is actually longer than the rule book.
And the last thing is listen to our podcast and there listen to After Hours, and we'll clarify
that. That's right. Cool. And actually, we've been talking back and forth here about going back through all our old podcasts and taking the noob zones.
And the rules things.
And the rules things. Anything having to do with... rules, mechanics, and sort of putting them in a separate file and maybe having a few minutes after each one where we kind of clarify and say, we forgot to mention blah, 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 kind of talk about them, and then make that like kind of a special after hours,
We had requests for that. That's where this idea came up. Yeah.
We is you, right?
Well, we'll have to go through it. We'll go through it all.
No, I was going to put that off on you. Oh, you have the software, right?
Yeah.
All right. Hey, I want to go off the rails a little bit on a question.
Please do.
If you have 4 tank teams in a unit, and they are all shot at in the enemy's shooting step, and they are all bailed, and none are destroyed. Do you have to take a motivation test?
Negative.
Because you have 0 dead.
0 dead, 0 alive. You have to be below half strength. You are at half strength.
Well, you're at nothing.
Well,
0 to 0, but 0-0.
But you're not? Yeah. Well, Well, you're four alive. Well, you're zero dead, zero alive, right? So right. either way, you're at parity.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, you need to be like a negative number, right?
Right.
If you have two dead and one alive, you're at minus one overall.
Yeah. Why did somebody get you in a tournament?
Well, no, I actually was wrong about that because I could have swore that we clarified that somewhere.
Nope. Because it's the same as if
playing it, we ended up playing it correctly, but regardless.
Yeah, but you thought.
That, it just, because that doesn't make sense. It's one of the rules.
Yeah, but nobody's dead.
Yeah, but all their vehicles are shot up and everybody's cowering in the bottom of their tank or hanging outside. Yeah,
I don't know. I think it makes sense.
I don't know.
To me.
I mean that it's a small thing. But
yeah. I mean it's the same as if two are dead and two are alive. You just saw half your buddies get blown up.
Well, there is that.
You're at half. You're two alive, two dead. You're
right.
Zero alive, zero dead.
Okay.
So yep. All right. I think that pretty much covers that. Let's see. John has a quick book review here, and I don't know if you want to cover that. What's the name of it again?
It's called The Psalm.
All right.
And it's by Martin Gilbert, Sir Martin Gilbert, who's a really famous historical author. He's written a lot of stuff, especially about Churchill. Very well respected. He generally does an outstanding job. So, anyway, he published a book on the Psalm, and I forget the subtitle. It's like Heroism and something.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the Psalm being the World War One battle, correct?
Yeah, we're talking World War One. Yeah, really early war, like World War One. I got it in a little paperback, and you know, knowing him as an author, I figured, you know, this is gonna be something that's generally pretty good. And so I went ahead and read this, and I'll just give you some of the details on it. He in the beginning of the book. He provides a really good overview in just a couple of pages of kind of the situation with the war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where are we at? He details the war so far. It's just a couple of pages. It's really good for the novice reader. Really doesn't know a whole lot about World War One.
Mm-hmm.
So that is very, very good.
Cool.
He talks about France and he talks about a small professional British Army, which is the British Expeditionary Force, and talks a lot about how, like, Kitchener is raising the new army of, you know, civilians and volunteers and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks a little bit about that. And again, this is just in a couple of pages, so it's really, really good. Ordinarily, I would think that would be, you know, chapters. So that's really, really good. He really tells you what's going on, and he's talks about the strategy that the Brits have to form the new army and basically have a knockout blow for the Germans in 1916.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that's really, really good is in the back, he's got over 25 maps, which is great. I love when books provide maps so that I can go back and when they say little town, whatever, I can figure out where it's at.
Okay.
So that's good. He also, at the end of the book, gives a really good epilogue, which talks basically about the battle, and I mean it's a hugely bloody battle. They basically make 6 miles of progress throughout the whole battle, and there's 170,000 Germans are killed, right, during this. Basically, the results of this battle prompts Hindenburg to come in, and hopefully you guys know a little bit about Hindenburg and what he ended up doing. But anyway, it basically talks about how that offensive, although it's a huge manpower loss for the British, it basically dooms the March 1918 German offensive that's going to take place later, and basically buys time and allows the Americans to basically come in and win a war. Because that's one of the things that...
Luke just stole a Cheeto.
He did. He just stole a Cheeto from
the
me.
The last Cheeto.
Luke! But anyway... basically, the Americans come in with their manpower and they actually win the war.
Yeah. I mean, like we always
do. Is that how it happened?
We win every single war, right?
Well,
we've never lost.
The Russians really won World War II, but
yeah, no.
Whatever.
I'm just joking.
So here we go. So the beginning, the first, like, you know, dozen pages are great. The maps are good. And the epilogue, which is about six or ten pages, is also good. However, everything in between is pretty horrible, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's not really a great book, and I don't recommend it for folks who are looking for, hey, this is going to be my first book that I'm going to read about World War One.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, in between those two sections, there's basically just very little that's interesting. Now, Gilbert does say in the beginning that the Psalm has been written to death, and it has been. I mean, there's a zillion books on the Battle of the Psalm. And that what he's really concentrated on is the human kind of condition. Mm-hmm. And but what it ends up being is you end up with endless two or three paragraph or one or two page stories about, and then Private Jones, who did such and such, and he's buried in Commonwealth Cemetery in so-and-so, France.
Yeah.
Good book to get if you're going to go tour the Somme battlefield and you want to look up specific things. But to me, it looked like it would really, you know, be better with these short little stories in some tourist information center around the Somme. Gotcha. So anyway, I would estimate there's only about 10% of the material is really devoted to the introduction of the tank, the political situation in Britain, etc. It's right. Not a good overview. So so for this book, the Somme by Martin Gilbert, I give it 2 out of 5 Panzerfausts.
All right.
Now, with 465,000 casualties in this battle, which is more than the U.S. lost in all of World War II,
right,
just one battle, it's definitely a must-know for everybody. Everybody should know something about the Somme, but this isn't the book to read about it. There's two other books on World War I that I would recommend far and above this, which the first is, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning The Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman, which is an excellent book.
And it was so good they made a convention out of it.
That's right.
Exactly.
It might be a movie, too, right?
Yeah. The other book, which is lesser known, but I think even better about a different battle, the battle before the Somme, is The Price of Glory, Verdun, 1916, by Alistair Horn. Hmm. Now, Alistair Horn came into prominence about 10 years ago, where he also wrote that definitive book on the Algerian campaign that people used for, like, the handbook on how to do counterinsurgency.
Cool.
So anyway, Alistair Horn's a great author. Verdun's probably the best, I think even a little better than The Guns of August. But, so The Somme, Martin Gilbert, avoid it. His books on Churchill and stuff, go ahead and read them. But The Somme is bad.
All right.
2 out of 5 Panzerfausts.
2 out of 5 Panzerfausts. There you go. Luke, do you have any emails from fans you kind of wanted to read? Well, we haven't done a mail call
this
in a while.
Actually came back a while ago. It actually came back in June, but because of Historicon and everything, we didn't get a chance to get on there. But I just wanted to let everybody know real quick that Scott... Scott Palmer sent me an email, and he wanted me to look into some European distributors. So I have sent an email to Karen King about getting possibly some stuff from them and talking about doing some reviews and talking about their website. And also...
their stuff looks freaking ridiculously good.
I want to get my mitts on it. It really does look good. And then also Kevin Wiedek sent me, and he talked to me about Forged in Battle. And I wanted to let you know that I have actually talked to Wendy from Forged in Battle, and she's going to be sending us a little bunch of stuff to review
Put
together and things like that. So for our overseas listeners, you will have these coming up, hopefully within, it takes a little while to get through.
It takes us a bit to get through that stuff.
And then we've got to get it painted and all that good stuff. But hopefully we have those things coming up down the road here. Yep. So. That's cool.
And on the subject of reviews like that, I hope you guys saw, I posted a picture of some game model stuff. I've now posted quite a few, and there's some pretty good looking stuff. Of course, Plastic Soldier Company, and we've got plenty of new Battlefront stuff coming up. John, what you got?
I did the little plastic bases.
Oh, the plastic bases. That's right. We made a post with John, and they look awesome.
Yeah, I want to respond. I mentioned this on the Facebook site
because
somebody said I can make stands that look better and things like that, and I agree 100%.
Sure.
Anybody can do it, but the amount of time it takes to do a base like that, and especially for someone who, if you have more money than time, as John likes to say all the time, then absolutely make your own bases. But these, man, I don't think you can really beat
those. More time than money.
More time than money. And
But I mean, the bases are inexpensive. They come with a bunch
of
them.
It's like $21 and you get 2 giant sheets of them. I forget how many it is. It's something crazy 16 medium bases and 12 smalls and a bunch of
other
junk.
And they look great. I mean,
they do look great. That, now, for me, and of course, it was the first time I did them, I did a complete Grenadier platoon plus, one or two other figs.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a little bit of time.
Yeah.
I read the Battlefront site on how to do them and this, that, and the other and whatnot. And it took some time to do them.
There's a lot more paint. There is a lot more to do.
And I'm a fan of put everything on and then paint it. I know other folks do it differently. They do the popsicle stick thing and all that other stuff. But basically what I did was I went ahead and mounted the figures, primed them, painted them, and it just took me a significant amount of time to get the bases assembled, to get them, to get the little grout put in or whatever you need to do
to fill in the gaps.
And then to paint them, it took me a while to do it. Now, it probably took me about, I think I said on the website, it took me about 4x the number of time I usually spend on the bases.
Right.
However, I think they look freaking awesome.
The end result is...
It was not that difficult to paint them. It wasn't that difficult to assemble them. Again, it was more challenging than my normal basing stuff. But, you know, I don't know. I'm a fan, especially for the price. I thought for $21, I can basically do at least two full platoons plus easily.
Yeah.
It looked like a great buy. And they had a good variety of bases, too, where you could put six guys on a stand or four.
Yeah. And they have the plugs, too, right?
So you can, I thought it was good.
Yeah, very cool. And so far, I have no one that I know who's picked them up has been like, yeah, they're pretty cool. Everyone's like, no, you've got to try these. They're awesome. Now, I'm personally not a big fan of pre-sculpted bases, so I probably won't. I mean, I think they look awesome, but I don't really like
them. Yeah, and I'm not going to outfit my whole army or go retrofit my paratroopers with them or anything like that, but I'm definitely going to use the pack I've got.
Yeah.
So I'm doing stuff like, well, I've got a platoon in the like regular basing that I do, the grass and stuff, and I got one in the city stuff. So I'm going to take my three Shreks that I can use in my headquarters. I'm going to do one that's going to be the new city bases in case I attach him. The other one's going to be the grass stuff. And then I'm going to do one that's hybrid. It's definitely cool and something new.
Right.
We have so much cool stuff coming up.
Too much, man. Too much cool stuff. I'm overwhelmed with cool stuff.
Absolutely. And then to top it off, you'll have the baby. And
you got the baby coming up.
So we got to pack
we
it
just
all
bought
in for
all
you
the
right
furniture.
Now.
That's why I was pretty much out of contact this weekend. We went up to IKEA. You know, man, I'll tell you what. I hate shopping, but going to IKEA, I'm like,
cool.
This is my idea.
I went
shopping.
To one in Atlanta. I want that Blorgzorg.
Yeah, exactly.
Or whatever.
But it's great because you don't have to talk to any salespeople. You write down what you want. Then you go eat for free. Like, that's the best part, man.
You eat for free?
Dog.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a big cafe up there. And
we had to pay in Atlanta.
Well, so as long as you buy more than $100 worth of stuff, you eat for free. So we only ever go up when we're buying something
big. Yeah, of course.
So, we bought tons of baby furniture. So
Right.
Yeah.
Can I tell you my favorite part of the Historicon podcast as I listen back to it?
What's that?
And I want everyone to go back.
My soberness? Actually,
that was a welcome relief.
Yeah. But. Someone emailed me, I think it was Joe Cohn. He's like, do you remember my interview? I was like, dude, come on. Do I remember your interview?
Setting the bar. Setting the bar, Steve. But if you listen carefully to the podcast, you can hear all the time. You can hear the pop of cans.
Beer cans. Oh, yeah.
All the time. I mean, at one point, it sounds like firecrackers going off in the background.
We killed that beer. I bought... I want to say Sean and Pete picked it up. I gave them my credit card, and they bought, I think, 10 cases of beer, and it was all gone.
Dude, that's
a
crap pile of beer.
That's a lot of beer.
And the I-95 guys didn't even show up.
They didn't even show up. What a bunch of jerks.
Yeah.
No, but...
No.
Apparently eating's more important.
Yeah, whatever.
Eating's more important than beer. Yeah, uh-huh.
No, but it was an awesome time. Great time. So let's go ahead and do this casino map case review, and you guys will have to pardon me. I have to get up and
we
grab
actually
it.
We did mention it.
No, you don't. I'm going to give it to you.
Well, we did mention it in the StoreCon thing, too.
It does look like a freaking law rocket, man.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and open this up so I can show the guys. And I actually plan on doing a video review of this, so maybe one of you guys can hold the camera for me later, like you usually do on Saturday nights.
Yeah. On candlelight setting, of course.
So come with this awesome plastic map case that kind of has these locking in place. You know, it's got straps so you can walk around looking real cool, kind of map case.
Yeah,
real cool. In the geek world.
Yo, what's up, baby? You want to know what's in the map case?
Yeah, nerd.
All right, so then you crack it open. You've got a nice big map in here. It's probably, I don't know, maybe 3 feet by 2 feet, maybe?
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly the dimensions.
That's a 3 by 2.
Can I get Cheeto crumbs all over it?
Yeah, please do.
What's wet erase?
Yeah, so you've got this awesome map that folds out, and it's a wet erase map, and they include a marker. And
you
so you've
have to
got
spit on it to wipe it off.
That's right. John doesn't spit. All right, on the right side, it has this honor roll, which is kind of the all the players, all the people who are playing, and it kind of shows how much experience their ace has gotten. Because, you know, it kind of combines these RPG elements as you build up your aces. And then over the bottom left, you've got all the locations, and you show the battles that have happened. And then on the bottom, there's sort of a mini...
Hey, Steve dropped
it. And I dropped it. There's a mini kind of calendar where you can show the next pending dates. As if you leave this hung up in the club or something, you say, you know, turn one goes for this long, turn two goes for this long. And the map itself is truly beautiful.
It's cinematic.
These guys, I truly believe Battlefront have hired the right graphic designers. I mean, if you guys look at the very first edition rulebook, and I've got it sitting around here somewhere, I'll find it for you guys. I mean, it's...
Yeah, it's not done by nerds. This is done by people who actually do art.
This is done by people who know what they're doing with design, and it looks great.
I mean, this guy knows nothing about the game.
Probably not.
Probably that's not a good thing.
But it looks... I mean, the painting is just phenomenal. The layout...
Yeah, it's really good.
They've really... And I said that even with Casino, the book. Yeah. So whoever they did that, kudos to... this thing's only $30, man. I mean, it's got me excited about playing these mini campaigns. And the coolest part, in my opinion, is it comes with these pins. I don't know if you guys have seen these. There's these little Casino Ace, little brass button pins, which I'm going to give out to everyone once the campaign's done. You got to earn them. But I think that's pretty tight. I think it's a good way to get new players into it.
It is tight. You don't have to have a whole lot of stuff painted to start
playing. No, you really don't. I mean, 500 points is the base level. Keep it infantry-centric. Good stuff. What do you guys think?
I think it looks great.
Yeah.
We mentioned that, like I said, we mentioned that at Historicon. I think it looks great. I had a good chance to look over it, and I wish I had a little bit more time in the Battlefront booth to look over it, but it was awesome.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I really got nothing else to say about it. It's, you know, I'm going to give it, what am I giving out here? I'm going to give it 10 out of 10 ace pins.
Okay, there you go.
What do you got?
I think I've got... Yeah, look at it. It looks pretty good. I'm going to have to say 11 out of 13 meat pies.
11.
Okay, 11 out of 13 meat pies. That's a good score.
I'm giving it a 16 out of 17 Stewarts.
Okay.
Wait a minute.
Fair enough.
I'm going to leave the two IC.
Well, you always take the first hit on him, right?
Right.
Okay, cool. So, good
stuff.
Put
the Cheetos in the middle, will you?
No, keep it away. I'm blocking Luke.
I haven't eaten today. I had to get up and come
right. You better not get no Cheeto dust on my table.
I'm going to get Cheeto dust on your table. This is going to be rough terrain. A Cheeto is...
That's right.
Any the Cheeto food mines. That falls on that food, Cheeto mines.
Agent Orange. Yeah. So,
You ate a bag of Cheetos.
I did.
Yeah, this man killed
me. I'm a fat boy. What do you want me to do? I'm hungry.
All right, so we've got a couple more things here. Guys, let's quickly talk about the lists we're going to run at Guns Vlogs, if you don't mind spilling the beans. You
want to
go first?
You want me? Yeah, I'll go ahead. First. Yeah, I'm going to run Brit Paratroopers with... No, I'm not. I'm not going to run the Brit Paratroopers, and the reason is if you run them in Italy, which is the only one I'm really interested in, you got to run them with New Zealand Shermans, which I ran at a tournament before, and the New Zealand Shermans is 3 Shermans, confident veteran with all the New Zealand special rules for 450, so they're out, because Steve talked about before, it's 1,200 points, up to 4 tank teams, or 400 points 400 worth of
points.
Tank teams.
Yep. So the New Zealand Shermans are just a little over that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so a little over that, 450.
Yep.
Yeah, so what I'm going to do instead is, since I've been painting them, and putting them together for a long time. Of course, this is the army that started with it's just what I've got now. It's grown into, I'm buying everything.
That's always. Yep.
Yeah. Is the Hermann Göring list. Cool. You can't really do the Hermann Göring list in the mid-war stuff.
Right, but...
So I'm going to do the Italy Grenz, and I'm going to do, help me out here, I'm going to do 2 platoons of Grenz.
Mm-hmm.
They don't come with transport or anything. I'm going to do the HMGs. 4 HMGs. I'm going to do 3 Nilwerfers, 3 Panzer III M's.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Because they're ready for our 3.
Yep.
And I'm going to do a unit of Pioneers, so I can switch out for the Flamethrowers. And I'm also going to get the cart and be able to switch out and get the
fortifications.
Three
barbed wire or one minefield.
Yeah,
in a defensive battle.
Right, all right. In a defensive battle, I'm going to do that. And I've still got 50 or so odd points left. I figure what I'm doing. I'm going to get a collection of Shreks or whatever.
Yeah, all your upgrades and everything.
Yeah, all that stuff. I was going to go with...
Ooh, you could add an anti-tank gun to your Nebelwerfers.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It gives them a little bite.
I don't have the model, though.
Nah, gotcha.
And I'm not borrowing anything. I'm not going to pull the Turner. So
That man is a borrowing fool.
Oh, he's a borrowing fool. I'm going to borrow a few infantry from Luke, but I figure he owes me anyway for painting...
There you go.
...like his entire garage full of stuff.
Shut your mouth.
So,
Cool.
So yeah, that's what I'm going to run. We'll see how it works. I figure the Panzer III M should be pretty good because even if I face somebody who has no tanks at all, Rate of Fire 3, Firepower 4 up.
No, I agree. I think I'm good with that. Tank.
And then if somebody does bring tanks, unless I'm facing Red on Red and do Tigers, everything else, I got 18 on them. Yeah. Be pretty good against.
Yeah, I'm thinking 18-9 is what I'm shooting for, too.
Yeah, the other list I was considering is Rommel with
four. Yeah, I thought about that, too. Four captured Stuarts.
I don't know about that, so.
Yeah, that'd be neat, though. How about you, Luke?
Well, my whole list is screwed up because of the five tank thing.
Uh-oh.
Right, Luke sucks anyway. So.
This was my original thing. I was going to go with the Strelkovi Battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to have two units of Strelkovi rifles with two platoons each plus a Commissar.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to run five Stuarts because I figure that's perfect and they're super cheap. Everything's fearless trained.
True.
240 points for five Stuarts. Yeah. Yep. Okay.
Well, you can still pay that and only take four Stuarts. That's the, well, that's the deal.
No, I want to get my 40 points
yeah,
back.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, 40 points in that saying, is not ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, if they will prorate those to do four, that makes more sense.
Well, what about looking into some heavy tanks? I mean, now
I look at
the
two ISU 152s.
Yeah.
They would
loan you ISU 152s if you don't have them.
I don't
do it, Luke.
I don't have them. But here's the fun part. So I'm going to obviously put flamethrowers in there and a scout platoon just in case I have to attack.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have to have the flamethrowers because I honestly, if I run up against a tiger, I don't have any way to kill it.
That's right.
Yep.
However, if I run the if I run this list, I'm going to run bum 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 cavalry.
Yeah.
Now the problem is cavalry only. I can only get. I think it is five stance.
You're not going to run your 25 millimeter samurai cavalry.
Right? Yeah, I'm running those and come get some.
And you're upgrading these guys to guards, so you got fearless trained.
I'm all fearless trained.
It's mean.
So I could do conscript, but I'll be honest with you. The more I look at conscript,
it's going to be hard.
I mean, there's gonna. You'll
get punched in the dinger.
You can't do it.
You've got to have a horde.
Exactly. It would have to be a 2,000 point battle, and all I would have to have probably 300 stands of infantry to do it the way I want to, because I would put nothing but those guys on there with every sapper attachment and anti tank rifle and all that stuff. So what I may end up doing is go with the see, the funny thing is, I could do the two SU-152s.
Mm-hmm.
And
I can loan those to you. They're what, 245 or something?
280.
280?
They're the guards. Bunker busters.
But they are mean, man.
Oh, God. Armor
7, AT-13.
I don't know what to do against them. Top
armor 2. They'll kill a tiger. And they'll stop most tanks out there.
And they've got volley fire, so they'll knock out guns. They're awesome. Yeah, they're awesome.
Yeah, they're really good. So that may be an option for me to go with. But I'm really stoked about running the Russians. So I'm going to start playing these guys and really get it together. So I think the cavalry, even though there's only five in the unit, it'll just be fun.
Yeah, well, I mean, you use them right. You know, send them through woods and stuff and wait for that one knockout punch on some guns or something.
Well, yeah, exactly. That is the thing. If I pin some guns or something happens and all of a sudden I can sweep around the back. And then plus, you know, remember, with infantry like this, I mean, moving 8 inches and, God, running somebody down, how great would that be? And then, and then in addition to that, the same thing. I mean, it just the mobility. And these lists are not going to have a lot of mobility, so you kind of get under the radar.
Absolutely.
With the, right.
With the cavalry our rule, what's our rule? We got to have two mobile units all the time, and you're restricted from having it. And you having those cavalry, it does give you two mobile units because you get the tanks plus the cavs.
And honestly, I'm just screwing around. So I'm going to play John this week, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
I'm just, like I said, I'm not going this with the killer instinct, like I'm going to run it down. It's more of a fun kind of tournament thing and get to see a bunch of people.
Yeah, I think Sean's running Finn's sans tanks. He's going trackless because his tanks are fearless vets, so they're so expensive. I think he was having trouble even getting something.
Well, that's like me. I can get like three Panzer III M's, I get like two Stugs. I'm like, I don't think so.
Yep. So I think I'm going to run Italians, and I'm going to do the Bersieri. So
you have no clue what your guys are like.
Yeah, exactly. Now, it's less wide in mid-war. It's either confident trained, confident vet, fearless vet. Good chance of being confident vet. But I'm going to do two units of Bursieri, so I've got the integrated HMGs and the little light anti-tank guns, because I think they're pretty awesome. Then I'm going to do Pioneers with them, with, of course, flamethrowers and a Pioneer supply truck. Then I'm going to do some cannons, because actually their artillery are pretty cheap, but they're basically like 25-pounders, so they're rate of fire 2, 18-9, you know, firepower 3 up. So they're kind of like anti-tank guns that can fire bombardment if I need them to. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then I'm going to take some mortars just to lay down smoke and pinning. And then 4 of the M1441s, little Italian tanks. Although I think I have the points to wiggle around and maybe get those up to Cimaventes, you know, with 18.9. So I don't know. Not sure what the mobile unit's going to fully shake out to be. I was even thinking about doing 3 Panzer IVs in support, Germans. Ooh. But when I run Italians, I like to run Italians, you know what I mean? Yeah. So, but that's what I'm looking at is the Bersaglieri, because I think, you know, I auto-defend in situations, which means I'll get to use my fortifications and integrated HMGs. So.
Well, that's only in defensive battles, though, right?
Or is only in defensive battles, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, I've got to be ready to move out. And that's one of the drawbacks of the Bersaglieri is that there's a lot of gun teams integral to the units. So, but they're neat. They're fun. What's up?
I'm just looking at a lot of the options right now for the SU-122. It's front armor 5, side 5.
Yeah.
I get 4 of them for 320.
Yep. I have SU-85s as well.
They're AT-10.
Look at the SU-85 because he's AT-12.
What's up?
The SU-85 is AT-12. If you can get those, I have those I can loan you too.
I don't know. We'll see. That would be the Tank Destruction Company, right?
Yep, Tank Destruction Company. But anyways, I think that's going to be a heck of a fun tournament. And so that's going to take us right into the question we are going to ask the Battlefront guys.
That's right.
And then after that, we'll respond to their most recent question. But this is for the Battlefront podcast. I don't know if you guys have heard their most recent response to our question because it was from so long ago that I couldn't even remember. But anyways, the question we're going to ask them is, if you could run, or maybe not if you could run, if you have to run a fairly non-standard Flames of War tournament. Like, I mean, what's the most standard? 1750, pick an era. You know?
Whereas
this one, you know, we're really changing it up some. What would be, in your opinion, a really fun non-standard Flames of War tournament? And I posed that same question to you guys, as we always do. So, John, how about we start with you? What would be a blast for you?
Well, for me, I would do one. I would just basically pick a book, and for me, it would be maybe 2 books. I'd pick Hell's Highway and Market Garden. Pick those 2 books and say, okay, you got to make a list out of one of these 2 books.
Yep.
And we're gonna have the tables all set up.
Yep.
Each one of those. Or pick pick a Tobruk.
Yeah.
And say, okay, it's Tobruk, so you get to pick a list, you know, here out of the new stuff or whatever. But I really am gravitating towards the historical scenario.
I'm glad, because I am too. Yeah. It adds a new element to it. Like when we did the Normandy campaign with I-95, it feels right, you know?
Red versus
blue, you're facing historical opponents.
Exactly. And that's the biggest thing for me. And I mean, especially if you're an allied player, you know, like we've ranted on 100 times, the whole blue versus blue, red versus red just, drives me insane.
Yeah, I hate it.
To have a scripted, and I'll just pick it, Market Garden, say scripted Market Garden, and you're either doing the Hell's Highway or you're doing, I mean, at least a pretty wide dispersion of German stuff and pretty wide dispersion of British stuff, and to say, okay, you're coming to the list out of one of these 2 books, and we're going to take half of the team from here and half the team from there, and off we go. I think that's much more interesting because there's nothing worse than, you know, let's see if my crocodiles can take out your Shermans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just like, what?
Yeah,
I mean,
agree.
It's just stupid. Yeah.
Yeah. How about you, Lukey? What'd you do, brother?
Well, you know, personally for me, it doesn't really matter. The theater that I'm playing in.
Yeah.
The thing that I would like to see is I do not like tournaments that say it's 1750 mid-war.
Yeah.
And then it's left open to whatever. Yep. Or better, worse, 1750 late war. So now you've got the Sturm Company facing my light tank company.
Yeah.
And they just should never have fought. And it doesn't make for a good game.
Agreed. So and I think that's kind of a WWPD thing.
Is have a theme. At least pick a book. Pick a book. Say you're playing at a Turning Tide.
Or a collection of books. I mean, there's some you can pick 2 or 3. Like Market Garden, you pick a couple. Or you could pick, say, Cobra.
Anything relates to each other. Well, then you just say Turning Tide.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's
Turning Tide. Turning D-Day Tide. Books.
Yeah, right. D-Day books is that. Or we're going to go out of Eastern Front. Or we're going to go out of that. And that's where I would challenge Battlefront to really look at making compendiums.
Yeah.
Where they say, okay, here's the deal, just like they did with Turning Tide, which I think is still the best book that they've put out so far. And I know you like Blitzkrieg and everything.
No, the D-Day books are
I think the D-Day books are fantastic, and they had a great idea behind it, and it was well thought out idea. And that's what I really liked about the D-Day books. So I think that
in the future. That's what I'd like to see from Battlefront. I think a lot of people would, is combining all these little books together.
Yep.
Because I think when I look at it from a price point and I go, well, I got to buy these four books or I can go ahead and I'm just going to buy one.
Right.
So Battlefront's losing out on $30.
And the big book doesn't.
But if I look at the big book and I say the big book's $50, but I get like these four books in here, I'm going to spend the $50.
Agreed. Yeah, me too. I mean, well,
and I'm never going to own the six books that went into that book.
And I think a lot of people are moving that way too. But but I mean, I think we can all agree though, just pushing these themes is really just you know, it's the way it should move forward. I mean, I think we're at the point where there's so many people playing Flames of War now.
Yeah,
you may leave out one or two guys, unfortunately, if they have one army for one specific battle, but there's so many people playing Flames of War, and there's so many tournaments. I mean, there really are. I mean, think about how many we get invited to. We're like, nah, sorry, I can't make that one. I can't make that one. There's so many tournaments going on.
We can go to two a month.
Yeah.
If we wanted to.
Exactly. And that's a lot. And you know, looking back, the most fun I've had in tournaments are the themed ones. I mean, that Normandy-themed one that, you know, where you and I went head-to-head. And we went to a North Africa-themed one up in Pennsylvania and had just an absolute blast. So I mean, I'm 100% in that camp.
Me too.
Here's my idea for a non-standard tournament. Uh-oh. And you guys would hate this. I think you guys would both complain about this. Maybe not. No, maybe not. You'd like it. But I'm thinking I would do 1,200 points, kind of similar to what we're doing. Yeah. No list restrictions. I would have it themed, of course. I would say, you know, Eastern Front, probably.
Right.
And I would say, you know, there's the spring thaw or something. Every open ground is now difficult. Roads are now open ground. Woods are now very difficult. Bring tanks at your own risk. Open lists, but the entire board is just crap terrain for armor. You'd see a lot of wide track vehicles probably, but they're going to be severely hamstrung. So it's going to make it an infantry slog.
Well, yeah, no, the reason I don't like that is because what you do is you force everybody to basically play the same list. In a lot of cases.
No way. There's a million. No, there's how many different infantry lists are there?
I understand that, but it's going to be the same general theme. Okay, so I'm going to want to, if I don't have a list that has wide tracks, then I'm really probably not going to bring tanks, but I'll bring a bunch of artillery, I'll bring air, I'll bring infantry.
So you'd be representing 90% of World War II, is what you're saying. I mean, tanks were, you know, it's not like they were at every battlefield like they are in Flames of War. I think it'd just be a new change of pace. You'd have a lot of assaults, because you'd have a lot of infantry.
Oh, Brits would win it.
But the thing about the game is not set up for that. Because when you look at defensive scenarios, where that's how 90% of the battles are defensive scenarios. So, okay, we're both infantry armies, and you've got to assault me, and I don't get... let's say, in that case, I don't get the benefit of tanks.
Right.
Because my objectives are in very difficult terrain.
Right.
Then all of a sudden, you're in a situation where, how am I going to get out this dug-in infantry with... They've got Pac-40s behind them, and they've got heavy machine guns.
But that's if you choose to play a mechanized or a tank list, that's knowing the scenario, which would be dumb.
Well, like I'm saying, but you know that... I mean, it would be tough. It would be...
Nah, it'd be a change of pace. It'd be fun. I mean, I've played like 40 tournaments.
I would definitely, let's say, play a game of that. I don't know if three rounds in a row.
Fair enough.
Because you're going to find out after round one, you're going to, you know, it's going to be like...
Ugh. The Brits are going to win, because I get Crocs with wild tracks, I get an AOP and artillery.
That doesn't mean they're going to win. I'll challenge. All right, you're on. 1,200 points. Spring thaw. You can bring Crocs and Brits.
At 1,200, I probably can't fit the 8 creases.
Yeah,
that's the problem.
Exactly. I think, I mean, it'd be a new battle. It'd be fun. It'd be a whole change of pace. Whole different thing. I mean, it's like adding
I'm not going to poo-poo your idea, Steve. I think it's
well, fine. I like the way the 95 guys did it on this one. And it's simply because... Because
they are limiting tanks.
Because they're limiting the amount of tanks you can have. And then that way, people don't have a distinct advantage over things. And the smart thing they did was limiting the points.
Because if they said four tanks, well, now everyone's going to take...
I'm taking four Tigers.
Yeah,
take four Tigers. Here's my list. What are you going to do about this?
Yeah, exactly. And,
okay, well, I've got four... whatever.
You know, well, they also limited and said you must bring... It must be an infantry company.
Infantry company, right. Not mechanized. Right. Infantry.
Yeah, but the support options for some of these guys... Well, hell, for the Russians that I'm looking at right now, the Russian tank options are ridiculous.
They're going to be... The Russians are going to be tough in this. They're going to be mean.
Yeah, I thought about that.
Because they really benefit from having an infantry-on-infantry slog. Anyway, so that's our question for Battlefront. And we have... They asked us... this is kind of along similar lines. They were talking specifically about the new fortification lists in Hellfire and Back. And their question to us is simply, to fortify or not to fortify? Luke, why don't we start with you, buddy?
This is going to sound like a rant, but I don't want to get onto it. We often say that this is not a historical simulation.
Right.
However, fortifications change the dynamic of a game.
personally, and I think we're all in agreement that fortifications do not fit my particular play style.
Right.
But I would not say there's a situation that I can think of where, you know, any kind of military unit went up saying, hey, we know there's pillboxes and machine guns and barbed wire strewn across the entire field and Panther turrets and everything like that. So we're not going to bring any equipment that can deal with that.
Right, right, right.
And so in the Flames of War, you know, in the Flames of War games,
it's unbalanced.
It's completely unbalances things if you're not prepared for it. And then it makes it ridiculous. In order to get through fortifications, and I'm not talking about a couple HMG nests because they are everywhere. You know, there were nests, you know, PAC-40 nests everywhere in World War II. However, what I'm talking about is what John referenced it earlier, the Sturm Company games that I played. I played three. And one guy actually strung barbed wire across the entire length of the front.
Right.
You know, he had dug in this and that, heavy pillboxes. One guy basically, we were playing breakthrough, just pillboxes right in the center. And it was very, very difficult. And it didn't make for fun.
Yeah.
I look at this, and I'm sorry if I'm going to hurt people's feelings.
You're not sorry.
If you play a fortification list, you're playing the game kind of like, it's fun for me, but not for you.
You're playing a blue deck.
Fair enough.
And that's the way it is. So my suggestion for dealing with this, because these are going to become prevalent, because there's a lot of people who you're not even really playing a game at that point. You're setting up and you're saying, now come get me.
Well, you shouldn't win the game during list construction.
Well, my problem with that is too, is that the scenarios are set up for, now granted, what happens is that you get one free for all. You know, or whatever, or one encounter, some kind of mobile battle.
Right.
But most of the time, there are two defensive scenarios. So with that said, you're going to win two out of three games and draw your third.
I'm going to go ahead and disagree with you, man. Here's why.
Okay.
These fortifications are expensive. 90% of them are nests, right? So you got your PAC-40 nests. Now, a nest just means you got to pass two firepowers to knock it out. They go down real easy. I think you guys need to play more fortifications. And that's not me knocking
you guys.
Yeah, have you played many fortifications games?
No, but I haven't even said what I thought yet.
Yeah, we'll get to you. Yeah, because I truly feel like when you first come up against, I was like, man, what the hell am I going to do against barbed wire? But I've played a bunch of fortifications games now, and I mean, they're just a part of the game now. Yeah, you think about them when you're making your list. Think, well, what am I going to do if I come up against fortifications? Okay, I'll add in my engineers, because engineers chew through barbed wire like nothing. You assault a bunker, they knock it out. You know, you think about having smoke. You think for the U.S., you have bunker busters. I mean, those little freaking 155s.
If you bring them.
Yeah, but if you don't bring them, okay, so it's the same idea. If I don't bring any heavy direct AT or any bazookas and I face a Tiger,
but you could bring, let's say I've got artillery that I know that I can handle these situations.
Right, but I'm saying you now know that fortifications are a part of the game.
Right, exactly.
So if you don't bring anything to face them, you're going to blame the other guy?
What I'm saying is now you have to change your list construction,
sure.
You know, based on all that. So now I have to take that into consideration. My suggestion for this is that I don't want to say it's a penalty, but it's a thing that people with fortifications need to consider. Here, I have two suggestions for that. Number one is that, I actually kind of like this idea for all tournaments because this is an old Magic the Gathering thing, is that you have a sideboard that you're able to switch
out. I like that too. I've seen tournaments do that. That's pretty
and
sweet.
And then the other thing, because it makes sense. Mm-hmm. I run up and I'm like, hey, pillboxes. I'm switching out my this for that. You know.
Well, and a lot of the engineer teams you can do that with.
Yeah, especially like the new Brits. Yeah. You can swap them at the beginning of the game. Yeah. You can take AVREs or whatever.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The other thing, and this is probably going to raise a few eyebrows, and you may not like this, but not many people charge pillboxes. They don't directly just run up there and say, we got this PAC-40, so let's move our tanks directly up here in the hopes we can get around. What do they always try to do? They always try to get around them, right?
Right.
So here's my big suggestion. If you have more than 25% of your list is fortifications, that you get a flank march on them. And it make it something like maybe a 5 or 6, and you say, you know, you determine ahead of time, you write it down or something, I'm going to come in on this side once they're deployed. And when you get a 5 or 6 in that, you get your flank march to come in. And I'm sure that would have to be part of it because that's what people are always trying to do, trying to get behind the lines.
I mean, I think they've really clarified the fortifications rules a lot. Like now they count as a platoon for deployment.
I understand.
And if you knock them all out, they're a victory point. So I think they have toned them down from the
start. They actually absolutely have toned it down. And I'm not worried about barbed wire.
Right.
I'm not worried about barbed wire at all. But honestly, I don't think it's very fun.
Yeah.
I don't think it's very fun to play that. Like I said, and I can't... I talked to John, it's like, yeah, I'm going to make a defense war list.
Yeah.
And it's going to be the, like, sit there and go... But you just sit there.
Yeah. But some people like that. I mean,
I know.
It's a different game in that you're setting up a puzzle, and now you have to solve
it.
I think
part of the problems that's going to come up with this, and I know, John, we haven't even gotten to you yet, is that it's so diametrically opposed to the way I play.
Yeah.
That it's almost... Right. It's inconceivable
right.
to me that people would want to play just straight up fortifications.
And that's my answer.
And not
too.
A theme. And not a theme.
That's my answer. Because my answer is not to fortify because I don't like being static. But I've also played a lot of games with them, so I really understand them now. Because I didn't before, but Sean and I have played a bunch of trench fights and the big push. God, that sounds awful, doesn't it? And so we've really learned how to take
in
apart
the jungle room.
Yeah, we've really learned how to take apart fortifications, and I think it's a good experience to learn because it's just like facing tigers.
I would challenge you again in 2.5 hour rounds.
Yeah,
and the guy takes 30 minutes to set up.
Right.
Well, congratulations. Unless you're
that's a different issue entirely.
That is a different situation, but that situation is probably not going to be compensated for in most tournaments coming up. Right. It's going to be 2.5 hour rounds.
So
Southern Front's 3 hours, which is awesome.
Yeah. But
yeah,
so I'll chime.
But they listen to the podcast.
I don't give a damn about fortifications, really. I mean, me personally, my style of play is less aggressive than both of you guys.
Mm-hmm.
So I do generally prefer the defensive list, hence. Infantry,
right.
and the paratroopers. Some of the stuff where you get to auto defend and all that other stuff. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that is solved by having a tournament that's themed. I hate to tie that kind of back to the thing, but
I think that's a great.
But if
you're going up in Italy,
right? Yeah. If I'm doing Italy, mm-hmm. I'm going to be facing some of these guys who are going to have these rules. Mm-hmm. If it's just a late war tournament, Well, now, am I going to face Russian heavy tanks or, monstrous...
So much harder to plan for.
A zillion Stuarts or, and it gets to become... So, anyway, so I think if you theme it,
right.
I think it solves some of these problems because then you got a historical reference, right, to know that, side A or B was on the defensive here. And then, two, you neck down your opponents because you guys know you have to build your list to face multiple opponents, different styles, different types of companies.
Right.
If you can neck that down and say, okay, well, yes, the Sturm Company guys are going to be available for this particular scenario. Now I've got to plan for that better. So that's what I would say is I think you kind of address it that way. I don't really have a problem with the fortifications. I haven't faced them a ton. When I have, it hasn't been a zillion of them.
Mm-hmm.
But... generally, I'm smoke capable with my lists. Mm-hmm. Even when I play infantry, I got 2 mobile units.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really bother me that much. Now, I mean, it might be a little scary if I have to attack with my Brit paratroopers.
Yeah.
But then I use Eric Turner's advice, and
I don't know. What?
Night fight!
Night fight!
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. Yeah. Borrow someone's troops and show up at the last minute to sign up.
Yeah, I think...
So, I don't have a problem with
it. I think we're looking at it all together. I don't want to say they're cheesy, because I don't think they're cheesy. I just think that, like we said, it's so diametrically opposed to how we play. It's hard for me to get a grasp on it. And I think John has a very good point that when we talk about tying this all back into the theme tournaments... Yeah. That makes a huge difference in how everything goes.
It solves so many problems.
Because I'm telling you, I'm gonna get PO'd when I get out there and I'm like, wow, I actually did ask that guy at the tournament I played. I said, is this fun?
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't do anything on your turn.
True.
You said, I'm done.
I think another thing, you like to play extreme lists, though.
I did.
I think you can almost flip that around.
Armored, that's only recently, and I've gone kind of
But like
crazy.
An infantry player saying, oh, cool, 17 Stuarts. That's fun for you to have 17 Stuarts?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is that it doesn't take much to really stop them, though.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, if they're smart about it, that's like saying the British Armor Regiment is broken.
See, my thing
if you're smart about it, you can stop it, huh?
You guys don't see it.
His face got red. His face is getting red.
I feel 100% secure in my statement that it's broken. I think I called it on day one.
Of the three of us, I think I generally play the most utility knife lists in general.
Yeah, you're very big on the counterpunch.
Yeah, I think my Brit infantry list is probably the most set up for just about any situation.
yeah.
list. But don't forget, I developed that list that way out of necessity because we did play so many different tournaments. There were so many different areas, and I don't know if I'm going to face Soviets with a zillion troops or whatever.
Right.
So
I think the other big thing to remember about fortifications is they truly cost out the wazoo. I mean, one Pack 40 bunker is almost the cost of two Pack 40 platoons. One pillbox that's a Pack 40 is like 235, right?
But how do
it's one Pack 40 with rate of fire two.
Yeah, and I think what folks have to do is you're forcing the situation.
Pretty tough
where
to beat that down.
Yeah,
though.
Where you have to avoid it. Rather
you just
than
avoid it, smoke it, stay out of its line of sight, or just take your lumps. I mean, it's only two shots.
Well, to Luke's point, which I still agree that the fortifications are fine. But to Luke's point, that's something that's very difficult to get a victory point off of.
Right.
And so if you've taken 200 and some odd points and set it aside, is almost ungettable for victory points. That doesn't
Well, it's ungettable based on your list.
Well, it also means you say take your... Yeah, I mean...
It's not ungettable to an infantry assault list.
Hey, look, if I build the 29th infantry,
right,
I'm totally cool. You know, that's fine. I'm set up for it.
I don't want
to. But like I said,
that.
I think what they need to do is they're going to ruin the game for some people who don't... It would just get frustrated and say, I'm not playing in a tournament again because everybody had fortifications.
Fair enough.
And I think they just need to look at it in the list themselves. And I think one of the things that Battlefront needs to do, and I'm going to call on Battlefront again to take a look at this, is some standard things for how tournaments can be done. And I'm not saying this has to be done like this.
But I think this can also be done by the community.
But agreed. And I think there's a lot of ideas out there, and then kind of maybe put, hey, you know, they can make a buck on and put a compendium out, even
there
if it's a download and say, here,
tournament director's handbook.
Here's the
That's beautiful. The you best know what? Practices. We're going to do it. I'm going to delete that because we're going to make a tournament director's handbook.
Okay, we got it. We are patent pending.
That's it.
We're
patenting
handbook.
This.
Can't steal it from us, anybody out there.
You know, I don't usually do this, but I'm going to go back a little bit. I am very passionate about the fortifications, and it's because my first real tournament, I got the crap beat out of me.
Yeah.
And John watched it, and you even saw some of this game.
I just sat there with the somebody farted face.
I'm like, what? Ugh. I mean, it was
what
ridiculous.
What the hell is that?
It was when the Stern Company had just really come out.
And everybody
And I have to admit, I have a bad taste in my mouth. It's like a childhood trauma that I got.
I thought that bad taste in your mouth was from Dirty John. But
no.
On that note.
No. So this has gone downhill.
But fair enough. The fortifications are very divisive. Because you're not the only person that feels that way. I disagree, but I completely see where you're coming from.
Yeah,
I 100%.
Like I said, it's one of those things where I don't normally carry 155 self-propelled artillery.
You feel about fortifications the way I feel about the armored regiment.
Right.
The difference is I've got numbers to back me up.
But also, you play
which
fortifications.
We'll get to.
I don't play.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, we're after hours.
After
if you want,
hours.
If you want to hear, if you want to hear, Steven, Steven,
we're
going to
go
to
town. We're
going
to go to town.
It's going to be a thriller in Manila.
That's right. In this corner. All right.
Luke the Kid Melia. Right,
so
what is Steve Magalacho Magalacho?
That's all I have, guys. That's all I have on the show notes.
I just want to talk about a couple stupid things I want to say that I wrote down that I forgot to talk about. And I don't know how anybody feels about this. You ever get nostalgic for games that you haven't played in a long time?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Because I was at, and I am not a role player in any way, shape, or form. I mean, I used to be a long time ago, but I'm really not.
Yeah.
But I was at the flea market, of course, at Fallen, and a guy was selling the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons basic rule set for a dollar. And I bought it like a champ. I bought a couple of things that were running around the Forgotten Realms. It just kind of brought me back. Mm-hmm. And I started looking
at my bookshelf, filled with role-playing books.
Yeah. I just started looking around and seeing so many cool things that were out there. I just thought it was awesome that they had so many neat things that just reminded me. And I actually went and got the full campaign set of AD&D.
Nice. Forgotten Realms, stuff. Right?
Forgotten Realms.
That's awesome.
And I got it as steel. I mean, I really did.
That's awesome.
I mean, and it was just fantastic. So I'm really looking forward to making that happen.
Good too.
And I'm also, I need help. I'm looking for a Star Wars fleet game. I played one at Historicon, as I talked about. I'm talking about one with the tiny, tiny ships, not the big ships that cost like
$15. Starfleet.
I'd actually own a clone fleet now.
Are you talking about Starfleet?
Star Wars.
Oh, Star Wars.
Star Wars.
Yeah.
Okay. Star Wars, but there apparently there was a game that came out with it. I don't know all the details. It wasn't very good, and then there's been some modifications. So if you're out there, would you please email me at luke@whatwouldpatton.net. And I would like to get that because my son and I want to play that.
Awesome.
And that will also lead into, I'm also looking for a rule set for Battlestar Galactica. So Steve and I
that's
can
right.
go
we need
all
to
blood and chrome
sure.
on some other
I'm
episodes
so
up
in
here.
I'm so in. All right, guys. I think let's jump right to After Hours because we're ready to go.
Ready to roll.
Ready to roll. All right, guys. Thanks for joining us. As always, everybody out there, keep calm and carry on.
Thanks for listening to News from the Front. You can find us online at whatwouldpatentdo.net or drop us a line at wwpdpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on Twitter and YouTube via the username wwpdpodcast or call us out at parties with "Hey, handsome." No animals were harmed during the recording of this episode, except the pig who gave his delicious life to temporarily quench our eternal bacon hunger. All copyrighted material mentioned in the show is the sole property of their official copyright holders. Our superior opinions are ours and do not necessarily represent the views of the companies discussed. If you have a product, website, or new dance move you want reviewed, drop us a line and let us know. Thanks again for listening.